Tonight on The Download, the CEO of Portillo's, Keith Kinsey, sociologist, poet, and artist Eve Ewing, and author and minister Kenneth Bedell. Now, here's your host, a man who just got let go from running social media for Ted Cruz, Justin Kaufman.
What can I say? I just like to browse. I'm a liker. I like to like things on Twitter. You know, sue me. Fire me. I did get fired. Oh, you know, it's funny. Like, it's one of those things where listening to Ro Khan do his Ted Cruz impression, as we just did for the last half hour, is radio gold. It takes you back. Now you know what the name Ro Khan. That's some good stuff, man. Great stuff. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight from our Allstate Showcase studio. Beautiful Michigan Avenue. A beautiful day in Chicago. Wow. Really, couldn't ask for much more today. Got a little hot. I felt like, you know, I'm transitioning my wardrobe to the fall, right? A more fall kind of look. Darker colors, a little paisley, right? And I realized what a mistake that was today as you're walking around in downtown Chicago and I'm feeling the sweat pool up underneath, you know, like in places I didn't know I had, like between my stomach and my shoulders, somewhere in there, there's sweat. That's never good, right? That's not a good sign. That's 42. That's 43, right? Yikes. It's like, what is that? Wow. Holy cow. What's happening? Got a tremendous show tonight. This is one of those shows where not only is it some of the greatest thought leaders of our time, really, but it's also a ton and ton of prep. It's, you know, when you book these people and you put shows together, you're like, oh, this will be fun. I'd always like to talk about how we beat racism. How do we solve racism? That would be a great segment. Sure. Then you put that together and you're like, oh, that's a bigger topic than I thought. Reverend Kenneth Bedell will be with us tonight. He's a former senior advisor at the Department of Education. He worked in the Obama administration. He's got a brand new book out. He's at the Hideout as we speak. He's actually on stage at the Hideout doing a discussion. The book is called Realizing the Civil Rights Dream, Diagnosing and Treating American Racism. Wow. But in the book, and I have to say it's really interesting, the idea that is part of the problem, the civil rights dream, as he calls it, the speech from Martin Luther King, is that part of the problem in the sense that it set out all these agenda items and what we needed to do to eradicate racism, and it just was never a reality. Meaning it's just something that we fell short of, and then we keep trying to get to these things that were mentioned in that speech, and we just can't get there. And so the question that Reverend Bedell asks is, do we need to shift the paradigm and rethink how we consider what is racism, but also at the same time, how do we solve it? And it is fascinating to sort of be able to pull back and say, okay, hold on. We know there's inequality. We know there's injustice. We know that there's mistreatment. Now, how do we diagnose what's happening in maybe in a different lens? And that's what he's talking about. So we'll talk with Reverend Bedell coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight. My guest in the 8 o'clock hour, Eve Ewing, Dr. Eve Ewing, a sociologist, a poet, a commentator, and a longtime friend. I've known Eve since she was 10. Yeah, I knew her mom. I worked with her mom at a radio station, so Eve would come after school and do her homework while we were working on radio segments. And now to see her become not only a tremendous voice for the voiceless, and commentator on Twitter and social media for Chicago Magazine to be singing her praises for everyone around the country, and to her debut book is outstanding. Electric Arches, we'll talk about it tonight. She's my guest at the big table. I'm a little intimidated. Yeah. I feel like the last time I saw Eve, I'm like, well, when do you get your braces off? And now she's changing discourse in this country. So we'll have a conversation with Eve Ewing. She's my guest at the big table tonight. Coming up at 7:30, as we mentioned, Keith Kinsey, the CEO of Portillo's, is in studio at the Download Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. I'm excited to talk with Mr. Kinsey because Portillo's is a really interesting study in brand identity. Portillo's not only it's a well-known iconic brand here in Chicago. We all know it to be a hot dog stand with beef and sausage and food. It's a food, of course, a restaurant. But their goal is to take that iconic brand that we know locally and transition it to a national brand. And a lot of that has to do with how do you make that transition? How do you sell Chicago food to the masses? And that's what Portillo's is trying to do. And they're being successful. I mean, it's something up to 44, 45 stores in over six states. But the goal of the company, the new company that now owns Portillo's in the last 2 years, is to take Portillo's nationwide. CEO Keith Kinsey in studio tonight to download on Chicago business. Is that enough? Can't be enough. I've got more. Later tonight, a new play, The Civility of Albert Cashier, is on stage at Stage 773, and it wades into the territory of the transgendered ban in military. How does it do so? It tells the story of a Civil War soldier with a secret. Albert Cashier was a soldier in the Civil War. They put this musical together to essentially call out that transgenders have served in the military for years in this country, including Albert. Talk about the play and what it means to be on stage at this point, this crucial point, when we talk about civil liberties and who can serve in this country. So we'll have that conversation through theater, through musical. It's a musical. The playwright will be in studio tonight. We'll have that conversation as well. And we play The Worst tonight. That'll be fun. Rena Kalm back in studio. Love Rena. She's a regular here on the Worst, and this is where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. And I have a feeling after tonight's show, where we have an unbelievable lineup, where we are going to solve all the problems in our world, how great is it to end the night by complaining about those problems? You know what I mean? A lot going on tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back, and we will do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, it's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's do the carryout. This, of course, a nightly segment where I read the news, so you at home, you don't have to. All right, here are today's top stories. President Trump had some Democratic congressmen over to the White House for dinner yesterday and to woo them over to his side for tax reform. Gosh, where are the leakers when you need them most, right? The leaker couldn't be behind the curtain and jotting this all down, live tweeting this. Wouldn't you love to see this? Don't you want to know what a woo dinner President Trump is like? Do you like your gold chalices? Who wants to put on these gold robes? How about this solid gold soundtrack from the show Solid Gold? Anyone want a tweet from my gold toilet? I mean, you can keep going. I just assume there's a lot of gold involved. It'll be interesting to see if the dinner worked and Dems join the president's push. And if successful, I really hope we find out what Trump had to give up. My guess, Trump steaks. Like boxes of Trump steaks. Someone check their fridges when they're done. The AP is reporting that the Foxconn incentive package that made it through the Wisconsin Assembly today would be the largest ever from a state to a foreign company, and 10 times bigger than anything Wisconsin's ever given to a private business. 10 times! More than the Mars Cheese Castle? I'm shocked. Not sure how this makes Wisconsin a more business-friendly state, but hey, they got jobs. I mean, the taxpayers are paying for it for 25 years, but they got jobs! I love how people... I'd love to know what people think who are into shrinking government about this deal. We need to get less people on the tax rolls. Except for the Foxconn crew. Cardinal Supich has banned guns in all Chicago parishes and schools. Feels like that might have been something he would have done a couple years ago. I mean, I'm glad he did it, but again, what was stopping this from being a thing? I don't know, like 10, 15 years ago. But by all means, kudos. Can't bring a gun to church. Okay. We're on to something. A new study says that the American household has hit new highs when it comes to family income. What's it mean? It means we're all the 1%. So it also means that we should go all in on a yacht, like right now. What do you guys think? Like a really big one that we can share? I get Tuesdays. What do you think? Former Governor Rod Blagojevich told both Chicago Magazine and NBC, nope, pass. No, sorry, not interested. It sucks you're in prison, I get it, but we don't need to hear more of the same interviews from Rod Blagojevich. Next. The city of Chicago is finally getting serious about signs in store windows. Wow, big ticket items. You got taxes, pension, violence, window store signs. Yep, DNA Info is reporting that the city has issued over 1,000 tickets and a bunch of fines for window signs without permits. This could be anything from ATM inside to we sell bagels. Small businesses are pushing back, saying it's making them hard to make a living in Chicago, in which the city said, excuse me, did you just use the word Chicago without a permit? It's a $50 fine. You can't do that. You got to have his permit to say Chicago. The new iPhone announcement today by Apple promises to change the future of smartphones. Is there a time travel function? How about a transporter? No? How about a 3D printer attached that can scan me a new pair of jeans? No? Then yawn. Get back to me when you can scan me a new pair of 511s, 511s. The button, 501 jeans of Buttonfly. You could start there and move your way up the Levi collection. If you're anything like me, you were intrigued that the words porn and Ted Cruz were trending today. Turns out his Twitter account liked a sexually graphic tweet. He blamed it on a staffer after the staffers blamed it on a hack. So essentially, Senator Ted Cruz is a Kardashian. There you go. A new study says that if you don't get up once every 30 minutes, you will live a much shorter life. I mean, we sit for like 4 hours and, you know, hold on 1 second, guys. Hold on. Sorry. I got to walk. Let me just walk. Ah! You do this? Here we go. Ah! All right, good. Boom. Going to live to 100 now. And weather saving the best for last. What a great late summer day in Chicago, huh? Seriously, who do I have to bribe at City Hall to make this weather stay till November? It's a $50 fine. Another hurricane watch. Weathermen are saying don't sleep on Hurricane Jose. Seriously, it's a hurricane. Don't sleep on it. It'll probably suck you right up into it or very at least rain on you. So don't sleep on that, Jose. In sports, the Cubs are getting closer and closer to crunch time here. They hold a 2-game lead over the Cards and 2.5 game lead going into tonight's series with the New York Mets, 2.5 over the Brewers. The Mets were a one-time nemesis for the Cubs, but this year they fell off a cliff. The Mets once had the best rotation in baseball, but injuries, the Noah Syndergaard, he almost missed the entire year. Matt Harvey, he's just wrong. What happened to him? But after that, I'm not sure who's even pitching for the Mets this year. Who's even on this team? Right? Who's on the Mets? Is Bobby Ojeda? Is he still in the rotation? How about Jesse Orozco? Is he closing? How about in the infield? Hubie Brooks still playing third? Gotta love a baseball player named Hubie. What about Wally Backman? Another great 80s baseball player. Is Wally Backman still playing for the Mets? Looks like a pinch hitter coming in here. It's Wally Backman. Wally Backman had an awesome mustache. Wally Backman. I think that leaves one team we haven't done this entire year when it comes to the 80s baseball players. I don't know who it is. I got to figure it out. I can do the math, but I know there's one. The White Sox had a weird day game today. They started around noontime, promptly lost to the Royals. Easy to say that this is just the way the Sox are, but man, the Sox have actually been winning lately. Last night, they blew out the wild card chasing Royals. It's the young pitching. I'm telling you, bring them all up. It's time. How great would it be to get a Cleveland-like winning streak going at the end of the year here for the Sox? Speaking of Cleveland, they go for their 20th straight win tonight. Corey Kluber on the mound. Amazing. The Dodgers, well, they go for their 12th loss in a row. Streaks are fun. The Bears are still smarting after their loss to the Falcons in week one. Looks like they'll be without Jarrell Freeman for the entire year. He's been put on the IR. Also, of course, they're without Kevin White, who's also out for the year. But that's normal for Bears fans. It'd be shocking if he wasn't hurt. But Jarrell Freeman? That hurts. It's so hard to get into a football team where each week guys get hurt bad enough that they miss most of, if not all, the year. It kind of sucks the joy out of it, right? But hey, Barry Minter once got hurt and we got Urlacher, so maybe Freeman is Minter and Nick Kwiatkowski is Urlacher? Come on, I'm trying here, guys. I'm trying. The Buccaneers decided they will host the game on Sunday as the city and state cleans up after Hurricane Irma. So the Bucs and the Bears week two. They played last year. I think I remember it. The Bears were coming off a bye, feeling good. Felt like we might get back into the flow of the season. Let me just look it up here. It was a close. Oh, that's right. Bucks 36, Bears 10. Yeah, I wouldn't worry about it, though. That they probably got worse, right? The Bucks probably got worse. That was the game that sealed it for me on Cutler. He threw a pick six to safety Chris Conte. Yeah, the Chris Conte. That's absurd. That's spitting in the eye of Bears fans to throw a pick six to that dude. In basketball, Dwayne Wade was seen working out with LeBron James in Los Angeles. Refresh my memory. Have we bought his contract out yet? Is he still a Bull? I was on vacation for a bit in August. Maybe I just missed it. Can the Bulls just get that on the old to-do list? Can we move on right now? And finally tonight, J.J. Abrams is back. The master of sci-fi and action thrillers has signed on to save the next Star Wars movie. Well, not the next one, but the one after the next. The next one. Abrams will write it, direct it, and probably cast a smoke monster. When hearing about this, Chewbacca told the press, hated the ending of Lost. That's the carryout for September 12, 2017. Hey, we're changing it up this week, going with cold burgers. It's all the rage with coffee, so why not ground beef, right? The burgers are cold, but we heat up the veggies. Can you say culinary craze? I can. Speaking of burgers, we'll talk about the business of burgers and hot dogs and beef with Keith Kinsey, the CEO of Portillo's. He's my guest in the Download in Chicago business. Coming up here right after the news, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
Met the nice gentleman from Portillo's that you're going to be talking to here in just a sec. Oh, the brats were so good. Yum.
There you go.
Good job, gentlemen. Good job. How you doing?
I'm doing good, man. I'm excited for another night here. I'm excited. You know what? I realized tonight, Tuesday, next Tuesday will be the first Blackhawks game preseason.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Well, that crept up on us.
Yeah. I'm excited about this year. I really am.
Well, you know.
You know, I feel like every year, incrementally, I get better as a Blackhawks fan/analyst.
Well, the sod father's back. That should give him some beef up front.
I love it.
Speaking
of Portillo's.
Yeah, just mix it in there a little bit.
It's business time.
It's time for business. It's time for the Download on Chicago Business here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. This segment, of course, sponsored by Signature Bank. This is our small business segment that features CEOs and entrepreneurs sharing their stories so we can help better understand ours. Tonight, we talk about one of Chicago's up-and-coming and iconic brands at the same time, Portillo's. The one-time hot dog stand turned million-dollar operation continues to grow in the Chicago area. Right now, they got 51 restaurants in 7 different states. A new restaurant is slated to open in Fishers, Indiana at the end of the month. The CEO of the Oak Brook-based company is Keith Kinsey. He's been in the position since 2015. He's the second CEO in the company's 54-year history, of course, the other being the founder, Dick Portillo. Kinsey is no stranger to the executive offices of many different food companies. He's worked for McDonald's, Chipotle, and right before Portillo's, Noodles & Company. Keith Kinsey joins me tonight to talk growth, leadership, and chocolate cake shakes. No, maybe not the Keith Kinsey, welcome to the Download in Chicago
Justin,
Business.
Thank you very much for the opportunity tonight.
All right, so let's get into this conversation. I'm amazed. I mean, for only 2 CEOs in the company's history, for you to be the second, what kind of challenges are there when you have a brand that everyone knows by the last name of the original founder and the CEO to sort of step into those shoes?
It's a huge challenge, but one that is so exciting to be a part of, because what Dick Portillo did and those 52 years is unbelievable. He created not only a brand from a standpoint of the food, but the culture inside of it. The restaurants themselves, the atmosphere, the service, the iconic element of that name and the food brought together with the atmosphere, the people, and just the legendary association he has with Chicago and Chicago food is fantastic.
What drew you to the job? I mean, because you had worked at larger companies. This was kind of a downshift, if you will, in terms of size of company.
Oh, that's a great question. It's so funny. I think back when I first came up from school, I went to the University of Illinois and came up to Chicago. I worked for McDonald's. And the two places I would go to eat was McDonald's, of course, and this place in St. Charles, on St. Charles World in 83. It's called Portillo's. I love the hot dogs, love the atmosphere, love the inside, and it was just a great experience. I said, wow, what a great place. Who would have thought 25, 26 years later, I got a chance to come back to my hometown, Chicago, and be a part of something so special?
You know, for you, I mean, part of the deal of you know, 52 years and the company selling to a private equity firm was growth, was this idea of taking this iconic brand outside of stores that are in Chicago and the suburbs and making it a much bigger enterprise, one that's nationwide. Did that attract you as a CEO? Is that the kind of thing that would attract you as a businessman to take over a company like this?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because when you think about what it takes to really grow something and have that kind of capability to go beyond, say, a region, Portillo's has it all. If you think about the food, if you think about the experience, you think about when you go inside one of the restaurants, it's so timeless because there's so much history in there and there's so many different things from an event to a conversation to a business. You can just take part of it. And for me, that opportunity to do that and grow it mm-hmm. was just kind of like that final opportunity to really be a part of something very special.
It is interesting because to make that expansion, you Portillo's as the brand starts to compete against different types of fast food companies. I think of the Culver's and the bigger fast food, the McDonald's and the Wendy's and the other places where before, I mean, I'm not saying you weren't competing against them before, but you were known to be an iconic store. It was almost destination shopping to go to Portillo's. How do you make that transition from everyone knowing a brand and a certain food to competing on a national level against a variety of different restaurants that can offer a variety of choices?
Yeah, you're exactly right. That's a big challenge. But what is so important about Portillo's is the strength of its elements. And when I think about that, it is the food. It's Dick Portillo and the legendary service that he drive and the training that we do, the people that we recruit. And the thing that's so, so special is when we bring people in, they stay with us. They understand it. They feel a part of it. That piece is so important. They're proud of the food. They're proud of the building. We spend a lot of money to make sure it looks right, feels right, and people are proud to go to work every day. And then that really carries itself to the guest. And then that breaks through. You don't have to do a lot of the marketing and advertising.
They know it.
Exactly right.
You know, I'm intrigued by that because I would think at a certain point, are you selling? I mean, when I go into a Portillo's, especially one here in Ontario or any of the ones that are in freestanding in the suburbs or around Chicago, I do think Chicago experience. Mm. Right? I walk in and what has been set up in Portillo's is a very sort of 50s, 60s kind of Chicago experience. So even the pictures on the wall, right? How is that part of the brand identity when you get into Fishers, Indiana, or you go into different states, and whether it be Arizona or California and other places, are you selling Chicago as much as you're selling hot dogs?
Well, that's really great. One of the things that was such an important part of what we did and Dick did in developing the brand for out of the Chicago area was taking that Chicago theme, but adding a little bit of each one of the communities we went into. So there's a little bit about Harley-Davidson up in Milwaukee and in that area. Up in Minnesota, okay. We talk about some of the grains. You go down to Florida, we talk about some of the elements about the beach and things like that. So it was so good about taking the main elements of the brand, but also having people really feel a part of what this was because it had pieces of their community inside that restaurant.
I have to say that's a interesting strategy because far too often when you go into a chain that is you can just go to one in Arizona and one in Florida and one in Chicago, they almost go out of their way to make the experience consistent in the way it looks, the way it feels. If you go into a Wendy's, it's a Wendy's. I mean, even down to the way that the chairs look. But in this case, I mean, there is some value in uniqueness.
Oh, you're exactly right. And not only from a standpoint with inside the building, Justin, but we also do it relative to the look. We have a diner look. We have a mining look. We have a prohibition look. And that adds to kind of the theme and the intrigue of people going by, oh, that's a Portillo's, but it looks different. Let's go inside and see what it's different in the inside. It has little nuances that are different. And we have the cars in there. And people love to go and have their pictures taken with the car. And someone, that, like you said, the pictures.
Yeah.
And there's a great story about Dick and his wife and how they built it. And from the doghouse, there's so many things that people can connect to. and be a part of. And I think it's so well laid out that there's an, you know, it's so important in brands to get that emotional connection. And those things do that. They're so honest. There's the integrity of what it stands for, not only finds itself in the building, but the food. And the service and the people.
You know, and there are no franchises. This is not a franchise operation. This is, if you're a Portillo's in Arizona, you're owned by the same Portillo's here in Chicago. When doing that, what are the challenges? I mean, because, you know, reading some of the articles that were put out when you took over and the firm took over, there was talk of, well, we want to be in every state, all 50 states. We want 10 to 15% growth every single year. I mean, how important is it to stick to those goals? And what are the challenges of trying to expand like that when it's not franchisees, when you have to open your own stores on your dime?
Yeah, you're right. The biggest challenge is people. And that is the core of everything. Because you can go find the real estate, you can go find the pieces of property, but ensuring that you have the people that carry on that legacy, that understand the importance of the food and the story and the quality and the service and the training. So it's going out and making sure you find those teams, you build those teams. We have an opening team. It's 45 people. All they do is go from market to restaurant to restaurant. They're people that have a long history with Portillo's. They understand the food. They understand why temperatures are important, or the way we do the dog and the sequence of what we do on the dog.
Yeah.
Same thing with the beef. And really teach that history. And that's so important. So that has to come first. The growth comes secondarily. If it's seven restaurants or five, whatever that number is based on how well we get that team together.
This is a download on Chicago Business. Keith Kinsey is my guest. He's the CEO of the Oakbrook-based company Portillo's. Of course, we know it here in Chicago as it expands to other places, including Fishers, Indiana, which will be at the end of the month. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. I want to talk about your personal experience of being a leader and how you've grown as a CEO in your own words. Keith Kinsey, my guest on the download on Chicago Business. Stay with us.
It's business time.
It's a download on Chicago Business here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Signature Bank. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Keith Kinsey. He is the CEO of the Oakbrook-based Portillo's, the iconic Chicago food. I want to say, I keep wanting to say hot dog stand, but it's no longer hot. So much goes on there. Now has moved on to having 51 restaurants in seven different states. And the goal with the company is to continue to expand the brand nationwide. We're talking about that. You know, Mr. Kinsey, it's great to have you here to talk about Portillo's, which has been a success story for Chicago. But your career, I mean, you have been a CEO at different places. Noodles & Company comes to mind, where you really have taken brands to the next level. When you get to a job like this, and you've had experience, executive experience before, what do you take with you? How do you evolve as a leader? I mean, do you figure out how to be a leader at a place and you say, I'm just gonna cut and copy and go right to the next job? Or do you take with you the experiences, both the pluses and the minuses?
No, that's a great question. It's the pluses and the minuses. It's really learning from what you've done before, but it's really it goes back to understanding the people and understanding what makes them passionate about a brand. Particularly, you think about a Portillo's, you think about all the other brands. It's what makes them so aligned with what goes on in that restaurant or with that business. And it starts with talking to the restaurants, the restaurant team, the restaurant people, and understanding how they connect with their guest and how they connect with the food and what's important to them and what makes them motivated, makes them, when they walk out the door, just like you want your guests to, happy, and you know what? I'm excited about coming in tomorrow and working my shift,
right,
and working my job. And taking those pieces and really dissecting them and using your experiences from the other jobs that have kind of, if you tweak them, whether it's some of the benefits pieces, whether it's some of the uniforms, the way they get greeted, the way you involve them in decision making, those things are so important to really sit down and listen. And the word listen. And really have feedback to them and give them that feedback.
Portillo's will always be known as a sort of a mom and pop type place. I mean, it is, even though it continues to expand. How do you keep that as a CEO? How do you make sure as you expand and you have Like we said, I mean, 51 restaurants in 7 different states. How do you make sure from a leadership standpoint that that remains the culture inside the organization? I'm not talking about what's facing to the customer, but to make sure that it's not sort of, hey, we're a mom and pop place for people who buy the hot dogs, but when we get inside, we are cutthroat corporate.
Oh, no, that you know where it starts is and every one that we've done is we have Dick be a part of that opening. And he comes in and he takes the time to talk to that team, the 200-plus kids, before we open up that restaurant and talk about how important the training that they've gone through, how important what he did to build this, how important it is to be a part of the community. We do fundraisers. We're going to do one down in Florida with the 2 restaurants coming up to give back and make sure that they understand that we're not here to take money out. We're here to be a part of it. We want to create careers for the people that come and work for the organization and really bring it down to that. Talk to the people when they come into the restaurant.
Right.
Make the families feel comfortable. And those are the pieces that when we have the openings, we invite those individuals in so that they can be a part of it and they can spread the word. Our strength in branding and marketing our restaurants is through the people that come through that door, the guests and our team members. When they're proud of it and they're proud of it that we're a part of their community, it's so amazing how well we connect.
You know, being someone who has had experience, a lot of experience in the food sector, what is the biggest challenge as a leader, whether it's Portillo's or Noodles & Company or working at Chipotle? What are the biggest challenges to leading a team? And beyond, you know, making sure you got the right team, I mean, there's factors that go into how the product gets brought in. There's factors about the government getting involved and how much people can get paid. I mean, what are some of the things that you have to deal with outside of just making sure you have the right team in place?
Well, it is those other facets. It is how do you do business in some of the environments? And how do you make sure that when you're doing that, it works for everybody? And also making sure that your partners, you know, it's one piece to have a part of what you have within the confines of the restaurant and your organization. It's really important to have the Viennas and the different
vendors,
businesses,
and,
vendors,
yeah, right,
out
right.
there that help us and be a part of it. They are partners. That's what I love about what we do. They're truly partners when it comes to our business. And Toronto Bread, all these different, Greco, all these different companies are a part of what we do. And it's very important that they feel that way because they go over and above for you. And you have to have those relationships because they do what they do very well. And we do what we do very well, which is restaurants.
When you put a strategy out front about wanting to go nationwide and expand the company, do you have to protect, and maybe protect's not the right word, do you have to be aware of the continued success in this market? Meaning, you know, you have a lot of competition and people who want a slice of your, you know, your business here, whether it be other hot dog companies or other fast food companies. Do you have to think about making sure you take care of Chicago before you take care of the rest of the country?
It is. What comes out of Portillo's is so important to have its organic growth out of Chicago. It is so important to keep this part of the business very focused, and because it's a couple things. We get a lot of learnings from here, but we have a kind of our growth for our people. Our best people going to some of these other markets to help kind of institute and bring about our culture come from here. And we got to keep seeding this and growing this and making sure that just continues to grow. It is a very focused effort to make sure it's kind of a dual. You've got your outgrowth in your other markets, but Chicago has to be your base, and it's got to continue to help you grow the other markets based on what it does here.
Last question as we wrap up here. Why Chicago? I mean, it started here, of course, but it doesn't have to stay here. I mean, you expand out. But what is it about Portillo's in Chicago that continues that relationship? What is it about being a Chicago company?
Oh, it's the Chicago itself. I mean, it's the people. You know, it's the food. It's the atmosphere. It's the way we're embraced. And it makes it so special. There's so much that happens here that when we go out, the people love the story, the Chicago story. It has such brand strength, and people love that. And there's whether it's the Italian beef or the hot dogs, whether it's the Maxwell, whether any of those, you know, it's just the Italians, our meatballs. We're doing a brat. I mean, it's just – phenomenal, the things that give so much credibility to food coming out of Chicago.
It's named every Chicago food. I love it. Keith Kinsey is the CEO of the Oak Brook-based Portillo's, as we're talking about expanding that brand outside of Chicago. Right now it's in 51 restaurants in 7 different states, but they continue. CEO Keith Kinsey, thanks so much for being my guest.
Thank
I appreciate
you very
it.
Much. It was an honor.
Thanks, Rob. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight, Kenneth Bedell, the Reverend, who used to be a senior advisor in the Obama administration, Department of Education. We're going to talk about his new book, which is really all about solving racism in America. Real easy topic we're going to get into a little bit later. Realizing the Civil Rights Dream, Diagnosing and Treating American Racism. That's the Reverend Kenneth Bedell coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight. Also, we'll talk about the new play at Stage 773, which is really wading into the debate and controversy over transgendered in the military. Mm-hmm. Talk about really the OG story of that, which is a Civil War soldier who was transgendered, who served in the Civil War, and it wasn't until he was essentially on his deathbed that he revealed his secret. And there was a lot that came out after that about whether or not he was impersonating a soldier. Albert Cashier is his name. So anyway, we'll have a conversation about that coming up as well later in the program. My next guest's new book is called... hold on a second. Let me do something. No, here we go. I don't even know where to start with my next guest because I feel like I've known her since she was 10 years old.
That's because you have. That's why. Maybe like 12. Yeah,
my guest tonight at the big table is a homegrown artist, poet, commentator, and sociologist. Chicago Magazine once warned us all by saying, ignore Eve Ewing at your own intellectual, political, and cultural peril. Wow, that's a quote. Eve Ewing just put out a brand new book of poetry called Electric Arches. Actually, to call it a book of poetry is limiting because it's really poetry, art, and short stories. It's her debut effort. Ewing is a leading voice in Chicago for issues of social justice. The former CPS teacher graduated from UFC. Got her PhD from Harvard, and now is back at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration. A longtime advocate and voice for the voiceless, Eve Ewing continues to push boundaries and establish new narratives about the city and the world that we live in. It's my pleasure to have Dr. Eve Ewing at the big table tonight. I can't even say I'm intimidated. I told Pete I'm intimidated.
Oh, you're so silly. This table is so big, so we're both equally intimidated. You're like 30 feet away.
My first question for you is, how's your mom?
She's good. She's good. I texted her and I said, oh, you know, tune in. I'm going to be with Justin on the radio. She said, cool. I'm watching Game of Thrones.
She just
discovered Game of Thrones like this year. Yeah, and she finished the first season and she texted me and she's like, that was great. I hope there's a second season. I was like, this show has been on since like the Clinton administration. But it's great. It's really fun watching her.
Well, you know, it's great to have you here. Let's talk about the book. I mean, it's amazing to me because you wear so many hats. You know, I've always known you as a poet, as someone who's coming up in Chicago and through your time at University of Chicago and paying attention to you on social media.
Oh,
but
thanks.
You have developed yourself as not just a poet, but like I said, an advocate. You've been a teacher. You speak well on Chicago school reform, things of those nature. I mean, where do you see yourself? Are you a commentator first, a poet? Where do you sort of classify yourself as a voice?
Yeah, that's a great question. I really don't, actually. A good friend of mine who Hanif Abdurraqib, who also has a book coming out this fall, he just gave this interview where he said, I say I'm a multi-genre writer because that's what they tell me I am. And that's sort of how I feel. You know, I'm blessed to love a lot of things. I have a lot of passions. And I just kind of let that guide me. And the terrible news is that there are so many bad things happening in Chicago and around the world so many times, you know, all the time that I'm never short of things to write about or think about.
Well, it plays out in Electric Arches. The Chicago plays a main character in this book.
Yeah, much so.
Talk about that, because you grew up in Chicago. You grew up in Logan Square.
Born as we know now. Yeah, I am a time traveler from a non-existent Logan Square. The Logan Square of the 90s.
How much of this book, this poetry of prose, of fiction, or not even just short stories, how much of it comes from, like, your entire life? I mean, have you been working to this point?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the whole book is it's a coming of age story, you know. And so my hope is that it's true. It's like true things that happen in my life. But of course, I hope that it'll also speak to broad audiences beyond me and beyond people that can identify with my own experience. And I feel like now that I have kind of gotten a lot of these things out, I've also sort of liberated myself to move on and maybe write about other things. But I feel like for a first book, it was really important for me to explore some of these themes of growing up.
Yeah, and I mean, really do, down to the point of even identity and race and
yeah.
and other things that happen. You're just riding your bike in Logan Square. I mean, there's a lot that goes into this. How as an author, how important is it for you to be able to live this story? You know, you lived it first.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, you know, the book is full of true stories, and I have this joke. I say this thing all the time when I'm reading, which is that like all my poems are true stories. And the reason that's kind of a joke is because a lot of the poems in the book have like time travel in them, or they have fantastic technologies. They take place in the past or the future, or they have people like flying around or doing things that could not be quote unquote true. Right. But I think part of the beauty of poetry is it allows us to expand our notion of what's possible and to see magic in the everyday world. So a lot of the book is things that I've actually lived, but it also gives me a chance to rewrite those narratives to be a little bit more magical.
You know, it's funny too, because reading it, I forget the piece where the old woman on the block yells at you.
Oh, yeah, one of the retelling poems.
And they, you know, just the racist approach, but the way you end the story or the poem is fantastical. It is it's a dream sequence of picking her up in a net and dropping her into Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
But it's told in a way that it is reality. It is truth.
Yeah.
That is what you were thinking at the time. Maybe not in that kind of prose, maybe not so poetic, but it is this idea that you would like to discard of this person who made you feel bad.
Yeah. And so the poem, there's three poems in the book that are that I call retellings. And each of them takes a true story of like a really racist incident that I encountered. So the one you're talking about is the first time I was ever called the N-word. So I was about 6 years old. I was riding my bike on my block. And
6 years old.
Yeah, 6 years old. I tell that story a lot because it makes me think about, you know, as you know, a lot of my research is about race and racism. And I feel like a lot of people don't realize at such a young age, children of color have to face race and racism and questions of race, even not just racism, just like identity. Like my first memory that has to do with race is when I was in kindergarten having a little girl, a little Mexican girl at my school come up to me and she was like, "Are you Mexican?" And she was excited that maybe I was also Mexican. Skin and we could both be friends, right? And I was like, no, sorry, you know. But I feel like a lot of times people don't realize how young we are as people of color when we have those experiences, when we have to start having those conversations. And a lot of adults are very uncomfortable having those conversations without realizing that for many people, it's not a privilege of choice that we get to have. But to go back to the poem, I think the reason I took that approach was because it allowed through poetry for me to kind of regain a sense of power and magic and fancy through rewriting a different ending, right? And that doesn't undo the violence and the
Absolutely
horribleness
not, right.
and the trauma of what happened, but it allows me to end it a little bit differently.
Yeah, I enjoy that style of writing. I mean, there's
Thank
something
you.
To say, okay, this happened. This is a pretty nasty thing that happened to you. And at 6 years old, riding your bike, you know, you can empathize. Right away, you're just like, this is terrible. This
yeah.
should not be happening.
Now, you want to know the real story of how that
Absolutely.
Incident ended? So so the woman said to me, she came up to me and started yelling at me. And I was riding my bike on the sidewalk because I was in first grade. So she yelled at me that I should like move my bike out of the way. And she called me the N-word. And then she was like, "Go back to your Jesse Jackson neighborhood." Right. And I went in the house and I said, like, "Mom, this lady, she told me go back to my Jesse Jackson neighborhood." And my mom was like, "I wish we lived in Jesse Jackson's neighborhood." She's like, "Jesse Jackson is rich, okay?" I was like, "Oh, okay." You know, so that was her actual response, which I've always
That's
thought was really hilarious.
That's a great response.
There was like no shame.
Eve Ewing is my guest tonight. Her debut book is out right now. Electric Arches is the name. She'll be reading from it at Loyola University Chicago on Thursday up in Rogers Park on the Rogers Park campus at 6 p.m. It's free. You can find out all the other events at eveewing.com. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Eve Ewing at the Big Table. Stay with us. My guest tonight at the Big Table, Eve Ewing. a poet, commentator, sociologist. She is currently with the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration, but her debut book is out now. It's called Electric Arches. It's wonderful. And I'm not just saying that since I've known you since you're 10 years old, but I am saying
that. Yeah, your check is in the mail for the cosign. Thank you.
Eve will be reading from the book at Loyola University, the Rogers Park campus, on Thursday, 6 o'clock, free reading, eviewing.com. We're talking about her book, but also just, I mean, you've had a tremendous run here where you got back from Harvard, and it's just been, I wonder what Eve thinks of what's happening in Chicago. You know, I mean,
yeah.
You become
Isn't
a
that weird?
You become a voice for the voiceless. I mean, whether it be school reform and what's happening with CPS, and I mean, you did so much work, and you've done professional work on the school closings in Chicago a couple years
Thank
back.
You.
And then also, I mean, just all the different social injustices we've had in Chicago over the years. I mean, you kind of are coming of age at the right time.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know if that's a good thing, but...
I think so. Yeah, I've been really lucky, and I think it's a lot of things coming together, but, you know, one thing I think about a lot is this quotation from Arundhati Roy, and she's like, there's no such thing as the voiceless, there's only the deliberately silenced or the preferably unheard, you know? And so, like... a lot of times people are keen to hear things that I have to say because I have Harvard next to my name or because I have University of Chicago next to my name or because, you know, I've published like in these prestigious places like the New Yorker, New York Times or whatever. But what I always remind people is like when I was a CPS teacher, nobody cared what I thought about anything. And I had the exact same opinions, ideas, skills. You know, I picked up a thing or two in graduate school. So I'm not trying to say like I was exactly the same person. But I always feel like, you know, I hope that in listening to the things I have to talk about, it will encourage people to also pivot and think about where our collective knowledge lies as a community and how many young people have things to talk about, how many teachers, activists, right, have this
wisdom. I mean, you've been talking about these things and whether people wanted to listen.
Right.
You've been talking about it since high school.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
you're,
true. That's
I
true.
Mean, so talk about that. Talk about the idea of why, a perfect example, why CPS teacher? Why'd you want to be a teacher?
Oh, you know, because so when I was in college, I used to work at this thing called the Neighborhood Schools Program. Shout out to them. And I worked in a first grade class and a second grade class. And I realized like how intellectually challenging and amazing it is to be an educator. And so when I got to college, I had a bunch of other plans. And initially, I was actually going to join the Peace Corps and go teach abroad. And then I lived abroad for a while, and I realized, like, I don't want to do this at all. I want to go back home. Maybe they need teachers at home. Like, maybe you don't have to travel to some other country right. to teach, right? And I love being a teacher because... on the one hand, it's like incredibly hard and also incredibly fun. It's so challenging. It's like the most amazing strategy puzzle you could ever do. It's so rewarding. And I also just took it seriously in the sense of, you know, when you're a public school teacher, it means that like the people of this city are trusting you with their taxpayer dollars and sending their children to you and saying, be my partner in helping me raise my kid to be the kind of person that I
you
want
think
to
about
be.
That as a teacher.
I thought about that all the time. I had a parent, she wrote to me once and said, you know, she asked me for advice at something and I gave her some advice. And she said, thank you for helping me raise my son. You know, and I was like 22 years old. I was so profoundly moved by that this person would entrust their greatest gift to me. And so, you know, a lot of times as a teacher, people would just say stuff like, oh, you're a saint, or it must be so hard. Or people have a lot of stereotypes about public school teachers. But to me, it's like the greatest privilege I've ever had in my life. I love teaching. I love middle school, especially middle school, man. I think middle school is just the best.
You were able to get a vantage point on not only what a teacher goes through.
Yeah.
But the political and social climate around it, meaning,
yeah.
I mean, everything that's happening at the time that you're in schools. I mean, you're talking about CPS.
I'm like the Forrest Gump. Like when I started at CPS, Arne Duncan was
right.
who I saw in Millennium Park today. I saw him walking down. I was like, is that Arne? Or is it just some other like 7 foot
really
tall, awkward dude? It looks like the president of the 4-H club or something, you know. So I think I didn't say hi. He doesn't know who I am. But anyway, yeah, I started out with Arne. And then we had Ron Huberman. And then we had like this huge budget crisis. And that was partially why I decided to leave the classroom was I became fascinated. There's always a perennial budget crisis, right? So this was
sure.
years ago and we had a budget crisis just as we, you know, this year we kind of have handled some things. But you know, I started to think like, well, why is this happening? And who are the people that make these decisions? Because I come to work every day and the kids come here. This is their work, right? And the people in this building are working really hard, have amazing colleagues. We have a great principal. Everybody from the engineer to the cafeteria person to the parent volunteers, all doing their best, right? So who are these people? Where are they? And why are they making these decisions that lead it to feel like the building is crumbling around us?
And
you know?
Also, I would say, to an extent, not being challenged on those decisions. There was a time, and you and I both know this, where you would have a CEO at CPS just sort of make decisions on turnaround schools or what they were going to do with curriculum or move things around. And there wasn't this fervor as we kind of have today in 2017.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think part of that, I left the classroom even though I loved what I was doing because I wanted to understand that power structure a little bit better. And it was harder to do when my nose was to the grindstone. But I think that even though now we have a lot more public criticism, and I think that a lot of the journalism community in Chicago, activist community in Chicago, do a good job of holding CPS accountable. You know, the bottom line is we have an oligarchy, right? We have an autocracy. We have a mayor who appoints the CEO. There's no approval process. Nobody votes on that. Appoints the members of the board, right? No approval process. Nobody votes on that. And there's not a clear sense of accountability. And, you know, I feel like I believe that if we're going to have a democratic system, we should have democratically elected representatives. I can vote for the person who helps make sure that my water is clean, right? I can vote for the streets and sand guy, but I can vote for my alderman, but I can't vote for the people that are going to lead the path to a good education, quality education in the city. To me, that's messed up.
You spent a lot of time, and I it's on the top of my brain. I can't remember the name of it, but it was either a dissertation or it was a program you're working on, sort of taking a really close look at the closings. The Chicago
Public
School.
Oh, yeah, that's my second book. I just finished it.
So that's your second book.
Yeah,
okay, great.
It's 2018.
2018. But it was really about looking at the issues of race.
Yeah, exactly.
And inequality and what we know when Chicago undertook the biggest closings of public schools in the nation's history.
Yep.
I mean, when you think about that, when you're a writer and a commentator, and you're involved and you've had the experience of being a teacher. And what is your first glimpse on how that kind of went down? And as time moves away from it,
right,
how it will be remembered?
Well, I'm going to shamelessly promote this book because I just finished it. It was like a lot of work, and I felt like I was crawling through thick mud trying to finish this book. But my second book is called When the Bell Stops Ringing, and it's about that topic. It's about the school closures. And it'll be out next year, but the short, and hopefully we can have another conversation
then.
Yes,
we don't want to. Right.
But the short version of it is that, in my opinion, and through my kind of analysis, the school closures in 2013 were the tip of an iceberg that went much deeper and had a much longer history, right? And that is a history that has to do with the forces that make this city the way it is. And that includes primarily segregation, right? That includes having a two-tiered system where everybody doesn't get the same resources, right? And it also has to do with what we were just talking about, which is a power structure, decision-making structure that is very remote oftentimes from the people on the ground who face the consequences of those decisions. And so to me, it's an important story to tell because I think that there's a way where when people are fighting for their schools, it's very easy to dismiss schools, these schools like, oh, these are bad schools. These are failing schools. Right. Rather than step back and ask the question, number one, why are these schools such important institutions in these communities? And number two, if a school is quote unquote failing, right? Where does the buck stop? Where is the accountability for that? The thing that actually inspired me to write this project that I've been working on since 2013 is that Barbara Bird Bennett, wherever she may be right now, Barbara Bird Bennett, who of course was the CEO of CPS at that time in 2013, she gave the speech in front of the board where she said, these schools are under-resourced. They're underutilized and under-resourced. And I was like, it's your job to pass out the resources, right? If I'm a teacher and I don't give kids a pencil or paper or supplies, and I'm like, you can't take your test because you're under-resourced, right? Where's your pencil at? It's like, as one person I interviewed for the book put it, it's like they poured gasoline on your house and then they're mad at you that it caught on fire, right? That's what that book is about. And I feel like I hope it'll be a good way of thinking about a lot of issues that are not just about schools, but about how the city works.
I love it that we're having a conversation about two books.
Yeah, two books.
Two books.
I started my third book, man. You're not ready. You're not ready.
I'm not ready. I'm not. Eve Ewing in studio.
I gotta eat.
The author.
I gotta eat, fam.
She's written several books. Her debut book is out right now, Electric Arches. She will be reading from it at Loyola University Chicago on Thursday in Rogers Park, the Rogers Park campus. Free reading. You can get all the information at eveewing.com. All right, we'll take a break.
Cool.
We'll get tonight's news, and we'll continue the conversation right on the backside with Eve Ewing. Stay with us.
Sweet.
Thanks, Rob. It's Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, homegrown.
Homegrown hero.
Homegrown hero. Poet, artist, commentator, sociologist, Eve Ewing. She got her debut album.
Yeah,
book.
My debut album.
It is kind of a debut album.
Sure.
Electric Arches. She'll be reading from the book at Loyola University Chicago coming up on Thursday at the Rogers Park campus. You can get all the information because she is busy. EveEwing.com. You know, as a lot of what you write about in this book, and it is a book of poetry. I guess it's poetry first, right?
Yeah. I mean, sure. I actually liked how you described it.
It's poetry, but it's also, it's got a lot of other things going on.
It's a book of stuff.
It's a book of stuff.
It's a bunch of stuff.
I'm fascinated, too, because you write a lot about your personal life. I mean, you talk about your parents, and you talk about your brother and your niece. And how important is it for you as a writer to have that personal connection? I mean, because you could write about social justice, you could write about schools, you can write about your own experiences, but how important is it for you to write about your family and your relationships?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I feel like I leave a lot out, like compared to a lot of poets and just a lot of writers. I've never been a person who writes like deeply confessional memoirs and stuff like that. I feel like I keep
that's
a lot
your fourth
of things.
Book.
Yeah, right. That's like once I no longer care about what anyone thinks. That's like when I'm 90, I'm just going to be like, let me tell you what this person said in 1992, you know? Yeah, but I do think that I think that like it's really important to ground things in specific stories. And so, you know, one piece of feedback I give to a lot of poets is like sometimes you go to open mic and someone will be like, this poem is about police brutality. Police brutality is bad for this reason and this reason, right? And then it's just like a list of things. And I think that what people need to ground themselves in a piece of literature like this is a story, right? And so I always tell people, this is why we tell young people, like, write what you know. Mm-hmm. Write what's true to you. Write what happened to you. Write about the time that you were on the bus and you got pulled off the bus by a cop and, like, taken, you know? And so I think that for me, I'm telling these specific stories about my family as a way of entering, like, broader themes or broader subjects. And to a certain extent, like, you know, you're creating a universe in the poem. And so the people in the poems, they're my family, but they're also like a character or a version of a person that's much more complicated or three-dimensional than on the page.
Well, knowing your family and knowing your mother and the poem that you're writing about their relationship, your mother and your father, and that she was playing tambourine in a Chaka Khan cover band was awesome.
Isn't that hilarious?
Information I did not know.
Yeah, I only found that out like 2 years ago. But see, that's a great example, right? So that poem's called Origin Story, right? Which is kind of riffing off my nerdishness, right? It's like my superhero origin story. It's about my parents meeting. But like, I know that story. I know my parents met at a Greyhound bus station. I like all the details of that story are true, but I obviously wasn't there. And I also haven't, it's not like I went and interviewed them or asked them about it, right? This is like a construction of my own mind based on.
It's like an arrangement of a story.
Yeah, it's an arrangement of a story. And really what it's about is like, what does love mean when, you know, my parents got split up when I was 4 years old, right? And they have a good relationship with each other and I have a good relationship with each of them. So what does love mean in that context, right? And it was kind of inspired by meeting people and be like, how'd your parents meet? They'd be like, my parents met in college and they fell in love and now they've been married for 30 years. I was like, awesome, my parents met at the bus station. You know? My dad was selling comic books.
The last line, I mean, you say a love like that doesn't last, but it has a good ending.
Yeah.
And I just, there's something true to that. I mean, that right there resonates regardless of the story or who it's about, if it's about your parents or it's about.
Yeah.
But the idea that you hear that all the time, a love like that doesn't last.
Yeah.
But to say it has a good ending, I mean, there's something that, I mean, not to be so cliche, but there's beauty in those words.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you so much. And, you know, I think that part of the book is like trying to complicate easy stories, right? And so my parents have been together for 50 years and they're married and they've always been in love with each other. That's an easy story. That's not my story. You know, I have to account for the fact that like my birth is a result of two people once loving each other, that now it's very difficult for me to ever imagine why they were in a relationship or why anyone thought that was a good idea. Right. But I can't unwish it because then I wouldn't be born.
But it also makes you who you are.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's important as a writer to be true to the story of who you are, not what you wanted to be.
Yeah, well, thank you.
All right, so let's talk about, I mean, there's so much to talk about, but I want to get into, I mean, you spent time and I'm fascinated because you got your PhD at Harvard, and there's stories from Boston. And they are very, they mirror a lot of the stories in Chicago when it comes to race and identity. But I mean, you know, being in Boston, what was that experience like being a Chicagoan who you were starting to identify what your voice was? You were starting to become you were a poet in Boston. I remember following you in Boston, but you almost becoming a Boston poet.
Yeah.
Or a Boston commentator where you were from, Chicago.
Well, I'm so grateful for that experience because, you know, I always thought I would go away for college. And, you know, I stayed here. I grew up here. And then I decided to go to University of Chicago. And then I became a CPS teacher. Right. And so all of a sudden I got to this point in my young adulthood where on the one hand, I was very worldly, like I had traveled a lot or whatever and had a lot of different experiences. But on the other hand, I had lived in the city my whole life. And it was very difficult for me at first to transition to another place. Boston, in many ways, is like a difficult city to get to know. And even just practical stuff, like there's no grid, right? It's like very twisty-turny. It's a very old city. There's hills, right? They're like all these different things that just different culture, different social expectations. I remember I felt super Midwestern when I had this neighbor across the street from me. And he was this like really loud guy, and he would stand in front of his house all the time and kind of yell at people from his porch. So it was clear to me, like, this guy is the neighbor, right? Like, this is the guy. I need to get this guy on my side, you know? And he would stand there, his super thick Boston accent. So I made all these cookies. And I, you know, I'm not going to say I made the cookies for him, but suffice it to say,
I had some
surplus cookies, you know? So I put cookies.
That's a life lesson. Always have surplus cookies.
Always have
right?
A little extra, right? So I put these cookies in a bag and I went across. I was like, hey, I make these cookies. You know, would you like? And he's like, nah. No, thanks. And I was like, oh, well, he's like, yeah, I have diabetes. I was like, well, you know, do you want maybe someone else in your house? He's like, no.
What about the gesture, sir?
Right. I was just like, where I come from, you know, I don't care if the cookies are like visibly disgusting, right?
You take
like
them.
You take them.
Right.
Go throw. Do you not have a trash? Throw them in the trash, bro. You don't have friends, you know? So that's when I was like, oh, this place is so different. You know what I mean? But it really grew on me, and it was really nice to have an opportunity to have like a basis of comparison. So it helped me appreciate things about where I was from that I had taken for granted. And it also helped me, you know, see the world a little bit bigger and see that, a lot of the issues that we face are the same. And that's also helped me in my writing because, you know, a lot of times when I write about Chicago, I write in these national outlets and people read them and they're like, that's Detroit. Oh, we have the same problem in Baltimore. That's happening with us right now in Philly, right? And it makes you realize that we do have these systemic problems that are happening across the country that we can have some useful conversations and think about building solidarity. So I have a lot of love for Boston, and it really grew on me. I also learned to really like oysters, so that was part
so
of it.
So that worked out.
Yeah, right. I don't eat oysters in Chicago. I'm like, I don't know where this came from.
You became an oyster snob.
Yeah, I just the origins are so unclear. Like, there's no way that you could. One time I was like, where's this oyster from? They're like, it's fresh. I'm like, that's physically impossible. This is not possible. Okay, so stop telling me lies.
It was fresh on a UPS
plane. Right, fresh from the Jewel. Yeah. Right,
right. Right.
Fresh from Jewels.
Eve Ewing's my guest at the big table tonight, talking about her new book, Electric Arches. Identity plays a big role. And this is something that I think that you have excelled at as a commentator, as a sociologist. The idea of sort of examining who we are and where we're from.
Mm-hmm.
And race plays a big part of that, but also equality and inequality and identity.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Where do you belong? And what is it about that concept as a writer and as an advocate and a commentator? What is it about that concept that draws you in?
You know, I think that we all have to understand where we come from to understand where we're going, you know, and I think that it's really easy to get on autopilot and not think about the ways that the world we live in has shaped us based on who we are. And I think that that also happens when you're in a position of privilege, right? So, for example, I was born in the United States, right? I didn't ask to be born in this country. It means that I have a citizenship that I did not earn, right? And when I listen to other writers, friends that are immigrants, friends that are undocumented, talk about what their experience is like, it makes me realize how much of that experience I've taken for granted. And oftentimes when you have a form of identity that carries a privilege with it, you see it as invisible, right? Mm. So you can walk through your whole life not thinking about what it means to be white, what it means to be straight, not thinking about what it means to not have a disability, right? Or to be a cis person, or, you know, to be born in the United States. And I think that in order for us to effectively love and care for one another, we have to be able to have those conversations.
Or understand each other.
Just understand each other on a basic level, right?
Reverend Bedell, who's coming up here, he's going to be my guest at 9 o'clock.
Yeah, that sounded real lightweight.
Yeah, really lightweight. But a big part of what he did for the Obama administration was faith-based. It was about religions being on college campuses, people of different religious faith, and to be able to learn how to talk to each other and learn how to understand each other. That far too often our identity gets in the way. Our identity becomes a card that says, I don't need to talk to you because I have this identity. I don't need to understand where you're coming from because I'm this.
Because I'm from here. Right. And I think that, you know, there are always going to be things we don't understand about each other. There are always going to be limits to how much we can, you know, walk in another person's shoes or understand their experience. But at the very least, I feel like when we start through understanding ourselves, it gives us a good position to start having those conversations in an honest way, and to lead with love, right? To lead with the idea that I don't need to fully encompass every aspect of your life in order to love you, celebrate you, and try to be by your side as you face what you're facing. So that's why, I mean, and to be honest with you, the other reason why I talk about identity a lot, Toni Morrison has this great quote that I'll paraphrase, but basically like, write the book you want to read, right? So to a certain extent, this book is the book that I would have really loved to read when I was 14 or 15 or 16 years old. And I think that we're having this conversation now as a society about representation in media. And I think that people really underestimate how important it is, right? And what it means that, like, you know, that young people of color very often don't get to see themselves, ourselves, in just positions of just doing regular stuff, right? And being heroes, right? Saving the world, or like going to school, or having a history that is outside of just a history of oppression. And I just think people underestimate how important that is.
Well, and I love the fact that you're in a position where you can call that out. And you use social media in that way. Twitter is a great example.
I'm on Twitter 29 hours a day.
and I love it because a lot of it is pushback. A lot of it is pushing back on the lowercase n-word narrative, right? which is this idea that more and more we're hearing about a story is somebody's story. It's not everybody's story.
And
there's this pushback on making sure that the media, us talking right now, or reporters, understand that several different people in this country see things differently. And we've run into a brick wall in this country when you just think about how conservatives and liberals talk to each other. But it gets even worse when you start talking about different ethnicities and the idea, like you just mentioned, the idea that many stories just omit the narrative of brown people,
right,
or minorities, or anyone who's who's oppressed.
Yeah, and I think the thing I'd like to remind people is, like, we just do regular stuff too, right? So one of my favorite TV characters, like, ever is Glenn from The Walking Dead. He's this Korean-American guy who fights zombies, right? And he becomes this action hero, right? And it's not just that he's a Korean-American guy on TV, but he's a Korean-American guy on TV, like, fighting zombies, you know? And I just think that that's so important. And, you know, I have my good friend, Fatima Oscar. She just wrote this you should have her on the show.
No,
she's
amazing. Sonia Denis, who did who was the actress.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, about the show Brown Girls, and it's going to be on HBO.
Yep.
And, you know, Fatih is a queer Muslim South Asian woman. And the show is about all of that. But it's also about, like, dating, and like, you like this person, but you can't really tell them because you also like this other person. You're not ready for a relationship.
Right. It doesn't lead with it. And that's what makes it great. And that's a conversation we had, right? This idea that doesn't lead. It's not a show about ethnicity. It's not a show about, it's called Brown Girls.
Right.
But in it, They're just doing stuff, right?
People of color. That's our tagline for 2018. We just do stuff, you know. And when,
when
I was
you go on Netflix, that's what it says.
Yeah,
just doing
people
stuff.
Doing stuff.
People doing stuff.
When I was a kid, my mom she used to come to my school and like read, you know, sometimes volunteer and read. And she always liked to read this book called Mirandy and Brother Wind, which is a picture book about this little girl, and she participates in a cakewalk competition in her community. And she always said she liked to read it to my class because she felt like my classmates only saw black kids in books like marching with Martin Luther King or like in slavery, right? And she didn't want them to think that like that is all of black history, right? And that we don't just do regular stuff too, you know? And so I just think that those diverse narratives are really important.
Do you see it, you know, as you are an adult yourself now? It's just hard for me to say.
Oh, no.
But do you see it getting any better? Do you see that because of your voice and other voices like you, even some of the women that you mentioned here, that there are more representation when it comes to narratives in news and media?
I do. I really do. And I mean, I remember, you know, my parents' generation, folks always talk about like if they saw a black person on the news, they would run to the TV, you know. So I think it's getting better. And I also feel like, you know, Ava DuVernay, she's making this Wrinkle in Time movie, and the main character is a little black girl. I saw the trailer and I just started crying, and it was hard for me to even imagine if I had seen that when I was 9 years old. But then I also think it's not just a question of like a black and white narrative. I think it's something that we are going to continually have to work on as a society, because it's also like, well, you know, where are trans people? Where are people with disabilities, right? Where are people who are at the intersections of these different identities? Right now, you know, in black activist circles, it's important for people to be like, well, you know, you all forget people with disabilities exist at these protests and things like that. How are you going to make it accessible? You know, for me and Twitter, I've been pushed a lot to think about how if I have a reading that I really like, I want to share a screenshot. A person who's blind and is using a screen reader can't access that, right? And it's not up to me to just be like, well, it's inconvenient for me to do something differently. So I think that it's really important for us to expand our thinking about identity. And a lot of times when people hear stuff like that, they're like, oh, so we just have something different for everybody, or how are you going to do that? Everybody gets their own thing. No, but just recognize that people around you exist, right? And whether or not you choose to acknowledge different people's existence, they're still out here living life, and you are missing out on their wonder and their beauty and everything that they can contribute because you're making the world inaccessible and scary to them, you know? And so, to me, a world in which we have all these different stories is not like some kind of an inconvenience. It's not about a quota that we have to fill. It's just about making a richer, more beautiful artistic world that reflects the real world in which we live.
And it's reflected in the new debut book from Eve Ewing. It's called Electric Arches. It's out now. It's a book of poetry, prose, short stories, some art as well. Eve, who is a former CPS teacher who got her PhD from Harvard, is now at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration. She is going to be reading from the book, a free reading, at Loyola University of Chicago, the Rogers Park campus, coming up on Thursday, 6 p.m. It's free, and she's also got a slew of other events coming up this month. You can find it all at eveewing.com. Eve, oh, man, total pleasure.
What a pleasure.
Total
Thank
pleasure.
You so
great
much.
To see
Such
you.
A joy.
Congrats.
Have a great night.
All right, coming up, I'm very excited. We're going to make we have so much coming up here. We're going to talk about a new show at Stage 773 about the OG story of transgendered in the military. We'll have that conversation coming up 9:30. And then also Reverend Kenneth Bedell will be here, former senior advisor from the Department of Education, the Obama administration. We'll talk about his work in faith-based initiatives, but also about his new book, Realizing the Civil Rights Dream, Diagnosing and Treating American Racism. Some light reading for a Tuesday night. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Rena Kalm's going to be here. Play the worst, 312-981-7200. This is a simple game where we take your texts and calls where you complain about the worst things in society, and we give you prizes. Come on, you know, if that's not bringing the world together, I don't know what is. So that's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour tonight, every Tuesday night. Well, my next guest's new book is called Realizing the Civil Rights Dream, Diagnosing and Treating American Racism. some light reading on a Tuesday night. Reverend Kenneth Bedell asked the question, is there still hope for equality in America? Bedell is a former senior advisor for the Department of Education in the Obama administration. He spent time working on faith-based initiatives in higher ed on college campuses. Bedell is a former teacher and also a minister in the United Methodist Church. In the new book, he wonders if we need to look at how racism works from a different perspective and recognize that the promises of the civil rights movement may not have been fulfilled. But that doesn't mean it can go unchecked. We just have to come up with a new way to approach racism. Reverend Kenneth Bedell was in town tonight for a discussion at the Hideout, and he is in studio with me right now, Reverend Dr. Bedell. I mean, there's so many different ways to call you, but I appreciate you being here. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Great, thanks.
So why don't we start? I mean, where does this come from? You have a foreword from Jesse Jackson, and you say that it kind of starts at his great speech at the 1988 Democratic National Convention.
Yeah, that was really, for me, a turning point in thinking about what it means to have a society that really works together. Because he used the image in that speech of a patchwork quilt, which he took from telling about his grandmother, who took all different patches and then sewed them together to make something of value. In the book, that becomes the kind of framing reference that everybody has a contribution to make. And it's all the different, if we think about the future of America without race, then it would be a time when all ethnic groups, identity groups would have their patch. And their patch, mm-hmm. Without their patch, you couldn't have a quilt. You have to, every patch is critical to making a quilt.
You talk that way and you can understand a little bit of your religious background, because that seems to be a lot of the teachings of religion, of the idea of everyone coming together and everyone having a voice. Racism gets in the way of that and always has, in the way that some believe that there shouldn't be people who have a patch on the quilt.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you mentioned, as you were opening up, to think about racism in another way. And even it's so obvious to us today that equality is a problem and inequality is a problem. But I would argue that language gets in the way of thinking about contributions, as if we're trying to make it so that everybody has equal something. Well, what is it equal? Well, let's not worry about how we figure out defining equal, which we haven't been able to do,
right,
and think about how can we bring the contributions together.
The argument here is that contributions are more important than the idea of searching for equality.
Yeah. That's what I would argue. One of the things that I think is helpful is to say, okay, what exactly is the definition of the civil rights dream? How exactly do we define that?
Right.
And only if we have a definition, then we can we say, well, then we've realized it or we haven't realized it. And what I would propose is that we define it in two ways. The first thing is that we say what we've just been talking about, that every group has full participation. And so, and that's easy enough to look around. You can look around at the United States Congress and say, well, is everyone participating here? Does it look like we've got full participation in our political process? Or is it primarily a group of old white men that make up the Congress? So now if you talked about equality, you'd have to say, well, doesn't everyone have an equal opportunity to be a congressperson?
So contributions and participation is really a better sort of way to look at in reality, as opposed to what could be when you talk about equality.
Exactly. And I would say there's a second part to it, because that has to do with groups. But the second part that I'd argue is that we need to not think about equality for individuals, but think about how we can make it so no individual has more barriers to achieving their personal aspirations than any other person. And so think of it from the side of reducing barriers rather than making things equal. And then we can see if there are barriers that keep minorities from full participation as individuals.
It really strikes me too, because you think about from that speech, that specific speech from Martin Luther King, the I Have a Dream speech,
mm-hmm.
and you think about the civil rights movement. And And it all kind of comes from the same place in this idea of a search for equality and all the terms that are used. You can make an argument to say that has moved our country in the idea was right, but the terminology and the concepts were wrong, and it's why in 2017 we haven't been able to solve this issue.
Yeah, that's what I would argue, and that while it was really important because what King did in the Dream speech was say this just isn't working. That was basically, and we're not going to put up with it anymore. That was the thing that he said. What I like about Jesse Jackson's 1988 speech is that he proposed a vision for what it could look like if everyone was part of that future.
Even in the book, I mean, the you talk about diagnosing and treating American racism, realizing the civil rights dream. How do you find solutions in this day and age in 2017? Mm-hmm. How do you say to people who have been systemically oppressed or in a position where they feel like their inequality is a big part of their life, that doesn't matter? Mm-hmm. That part doesn't matter. You know, we're going to reset the button and we're going to try again. How do you do that in a way that everyone would say, yeah, I think it's all going to work out this time?
Yeah. That certainly is the important question. And I hope that my book is able to help contribute to that conversation. I'd argue that there have been, since the 1960s, some really important new understandings about sociology and social psychology and the way that societies function that Dr. King couldn't have possibly known about because much of that theory wasn't developed. There are a number of strands, but we can kind of summarize three quickly. One is that institutional racism is really two kinds of institutional racism. There's the institutional racism that isn't essential for the workings of the institution. It's part of what happens, and it may be that minorities aren't hired in the same way, or that people who went to an HBCU aren't given the same opportunities that someone that went to an Ivy League or whatever. Those kinds of things. But it doesn't really impact the institution. So that kind of institutional racism, we just need to become aware of, sensitive to, and work on. There's another kind of institutional racism that one of the places that I think we've become really aware of it is in the work that's been done in the New Jim Crow. And looking at the way that the prison system and the criminal justice system, but those
someone
are
who's profiting off of segregation and racism,
and actually institutionalizing a structure that creates racism within the society. And one of the things that social psychologists and sociologists have figured out, there's a Frenchman, Foucault's his name, who looked at these disciplinary institutions that are where their purpose is to change people and to make sure that the racism is supported. Schools can be that, not all schools, but schools can be that way if they're designed to deny people their full participation in their own ethnic group, for example.
Kenneth Bedell is my guest, a reverend doctor and former teacher, minister in the United Methodist Church, former senior advisor in the Department of Education for the Obama administration. His book is called Realizing the Civil Rights Dream, Diagnosing and Treating American Racism. That's what we're talking about tonight. I really truly believe that there are connections and pathways and parallels to your work in faith-based initiatives and the idea of what you're doing in the Obama administration to have different religions talk to each other, understand each other. It seems like one of the pathways that could be used would be the church to sort of decide on a new way and a new course to sort of find solutions for racism. Mm-hmm. Kenneth Bedell, my guest, let's do this. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll talk about that part of the equation here on The Download. Stay with us. We're well on our way tonight to solving racism with our guest, Reverend Kenneth Bedell. He's he was a senior advisor in the Department of Education, the Obama administration. Spent time working on faith-based initiatives on college campuses. The book is called Realizing the Civil Rights Dream, Diagnosing and Treating American Racism, Reverend Bedell was in town tonight for a reading at the Hideout. He just came right to the studio from there. I'm fascinated with your work, like I mentioned, with religion, because it feels to me like there's parallels there. If religions took center stage and said, we're going to be the ones, and whether it be in the church or the synagogue or any other place, the mosque, where we said, hey, we're gonna tackle this issue of racism together. We're going to help understand how other people are approaching this, but also what other people are better understand where they're coming from. Religion does play a big part in sort of stereotypes.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And I was privileged, as you mentioned, to work on the President's Interfaith and Community Service Campus Challenge. It was President Obama who actually had what I think was just a brilliant insight. That was that if you want to get Jews and Muslims and Christians and Hindus to talk with each other, that the way to do it is not to start out and say, okay, what do you think about God? But to get them to work together on a community service project. And so he called it the Interfaith and Community Service Campus Challenge.
And the goal was to have people understand each other from different religious backgrounds without talking religion.
That they'd start out and they'd go and do a project. And they'd work on something right here in Chicago. Trinity Christian College did a project with a mosque where they cleaned up a trail. Well, then they'd go back to campus, and the people from the mosque would sit with the people from Trinity Christian College, and the conversation was about why do they value doing that for the community? What came out of that? Well, then that took them to the place of where they were able to talk to each other because they already had a place of commonality to stand on.
I would assume a lot of this starts at the college campuses where there is this identity, especially when you're trying to figure out who you are and what how you're going to contribute to society, that religion plays a big part, your background, who you were. You're not necessarily open to hearing the other person's point of view, a different religion's point of view, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and one of the things that we discovered was that across the country, there were people on college campuses that were staff, or maybe there were even several chaplains that really kind of wanted to have that happen, what you're describing. Yeah. And that then when the President of the United States says, well, I challenge you to have some programs or to increase programs on your campus where people of different faiths are going to start out working together and then also have a component of sharing then about what that means to them. And it just kind of blossomed. It was like there was the right thing for the right time. And I think sometimes these administrators, they'd be able to go then to their dean or to their president and say, look, let's be part of something. This is a national program.
From that experience and the experience of being a part of that interfaith movement and challenge at universities and colleges across the country, How has that informed the work you're doing now with the civil rights book that you just put out? The idea that we need to redefine or recategorize or at least rethink what racism is.
Yeah.
Is it the same concept at the end of the day that we need people to who may have, and I don't want to say are racist because that's not what I mean, but the idea that to better understand each other we need to find common ground.
Yeah. And I think it's helpful, like when you kind of started to say, well, what's racist, to realize that I think everybody is kind of in a soup of racism, and everybody participates often unintentionally in racist activities and are participants in things. And so that it's helpful to think about racist activities rather than racist people. Now, there are some people who claim to be racist, and then you can allow that. I mean, they say that's what they are and let them.
And wear it as a badge, right?
Yeah. But for the rest of us, we need to focus on what is the activity. And that's where the place is really important, I think, in the conversation that you're talking about, to work on how do we engage and think about what it means to get in the other person's moccasins, or to, how would I like other people to think about me, or how would I feel if people were saying
it's amazing. And I talked about this with Eve Ewing in the last segment as well, but I mean, there really is what we seem to be losing in this country is this understanding of the people that were having arguments with. Empathy, just the idea of where people are coming from or who these people are or what, you know, it always boils down to a conservative, liberal, political fight. But we see more often religion plays a big role, race plays a big role. At a certain point, we have to find ways that we all can talk to each other before we talk to each other.
Yeah, yeah. And I got a friend who explained to me how important it is to have the, he called it the family talk. So the place where you can talk about, well, who are we as a people? What's important about our family? How are we special? And then you have your public conversation and the way that you share things. And without that private conversation, which I think kind of the formation, the way we've kind of form ourselves, then we're not, without that, we're not ready to engage with others with a kind of integrity. And I think going back to what I was saying about college campuses, that's another place where it's easier for college students to begin with the thing that they know. Wow, I think it's so important to preserve the environment or to build houses for the poor or to help with a food bank. They can start with identifying that and then realize, hey, this is who I am. This is my faith. And the other, and then they can talk to other people.
You know, as I mean, the subtitle of the book is Diagnosing and Treating American Racism. As you diagnose it and you see that really we just need to figure out how to classify it in a better way, how do you treat it? I mean, once we get to a certain point where people are talking and they say, okay, I can understand, I do want to contribute. How do you keep it from what seems to, in this conversation we've had, to be a normal human trait, right? Yeah. How do you keep it from spoiling a new system?
That's a complicated question, but I'd like
to... We only have 2 minutes left.
Oh, 2 minutes. Okay. So I'll throw out one thing, and that is, I think when we think about our... We have certain things that we just sort of understand. Like, we have a sense of humor. Different people have a different sense of humor, and even different cultures have different senses of humor. But there's also a sense of racism. And one of the things that we can do in terms of the treatment is to really take seriously with each other developing our sense of racism. When we see racism, to point it out to each other, to take seriously helping each other come to make it and so that it's part of our sense, so we don't just make excuses for what happens, but we really can see where that is. And a big part of that is listening across racial groups and ethnic groups. And when someone says, well, you know, that was a racist thing, not to say, oh, no, they were just having a bad day, or, you know, the bus driver wasn't really being racist. No, it may have been to really be able to see where bus drivers are racist at times. So there may be a racist activity that evolves.
And that would be a way that we would change it in society, especially if you took away the heft. You know, if you're called out for racist activities, That's a deal breaker. Mm-hmm. That could be a life change for you. But if in a different situation you were called out, it still was important and still serious, but it wasn't this sort of like, you know, everybody get the bus driver.
Yeah.
You know,
it
would be a way that we could move forward and get past these things that keep tripping us up.
Yeah. I think that's one really important part of the treatment. Another part of the treatment is to go ahead and get involved in things like judicial reform. It's just to not make a pun, but it's criminal.
The
current justice system.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because that came up with Eve's conversation as well. Reverend Kenneth Bedell, senior advisor for the Department of Education during the Obama administration, spent time working in faith-based initiatives in higher ed and college campuses, the interfaith challenge that we just talked about. Former teacher, also a minister in the United Methodist Church. His new book is called Realizing the Civil Rights Dream, Diagnosing and Treating American Racism. A light little conversation on Tuesday.
Good.
Reverend Bedell, a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Justin.
Great to have Kenneth Bedell here. He's got a... He had tonight the book signing over at the Hideout, but he's also got a brown bag discussion tomorrow at the Omnia Institute, 205 West Monroe. So that's at noon tomorrow, September 13th, noon. You can find out that information. You can RSVP at 312-626-1213, 312-626-1213. Brown bag discussion with Reverend Kenneth Bedell. That's coming up tomorrow at noon. right. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, coming up in the 10 o'clock hour tonight. Rena Kalm is back in the house. Very excited to have her. As we play the worst, 312-981-7200. This is, of course, our favorite segment where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. Mostly pizza. Oh, yeah. I mean, where else can you complain about someone leaving their turn signal on in front of you or honking or something like that and possibly walk away with seeing Jamie Farr at the Mac Center in DuPage?
How fun.
Right? That's what I'm just saying. Like, I feel like there's too many. It's an embarrassment of riches for you to call in and text in and complain about something. And if it's the best, the judges, the comics are the judges. If it's the best, you get prizes.
Yeah, absolutely.
It beats just complaining out your car window, right? Oh, you don't get anything out of that.
Oh, yeah.
So there you go. So that's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour tonight here on the Download. Well, the world premiere, it's a world premiere being produced at Stage 773 in Lakeview. It's called The Civility of Albert Cashier. It's on stage through October 15th. It's a Civil War musical about the life and secret of Civil War soldier Albert Cashier. The story starts in the Civil War, follows Albert afterwards as he grows older, gets dementia. In that time, Cashier's lifelong secret is revealed. He was born a woman. This causes a huge uproar in the southern Illinois community where he lived, and he was eventually prosecuted for impersonating a soldier. A true story, and a story that is timely as ever due to the recent ban on transgendered in the military. In studio with me tonight, the playwright of The Civility of Albert Cashier, Jay Derritany. Jay, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Justin. It's great being here.
How much did you know of this story before you started writing the play?
Very little. I happen to be a history buff, and I just one day was looking at, I don't know if it was a History Channel or some channel, and saw something. And then I started Googling Albert's life, and I became fascinated by the story that hasn't been told. We have so many stories about, you know, white men, and that's great and all, but we have no stories about women in the military. Did you know that 1,000 women fought in the Civil War?
Yeah.
And even more in World War I and different people, actual combat, too. And 1,000 women fought in the American Civil War, but this particular woman, Albert Cashier, who was born Jenny Hodgers, took the name Albert, lived her life, his life, I should use a correct pronoun, his life as a man during the war, but then after the war, continued to live as a man until his death.
Yeah, there's not, I mean, and I just am going over anecdotal history and information that I know and I've taken in, that there's just not a lot of public knowledge when it comes to trans issues in the military in the 18th, 19th century. I mean, I would assume that this is more, I mean, because when you see what comes out with the ban, the executive order to ban transgendered in the military, now it comes out, comes out with numbers,
right?
8,000, 10,000, you know, 15, whatever it is. But I would assume that as you point out in this play, in this musical, this was a secret.
Oh yeah. This was a secret during the military, although during the Civil War, although I think, and there's pretty good evidence that several of the soldiers probably knew and kept the secret, kept Albert's secret. But why wouldn't they? Albert was a tremendous war hero. He fought in over 40 battles, including the bloodiest Battle of Vicksburg. At one point, had taken the flag and put it back up on a tree, was caught by the Confederates, escaped his Confederate captors, and then came back and fought again in many more battles. Back in the Civil War days, oftentimes if you were caught and you could escape, you just went home. They didn't really have a way of checking that out. But Albert continued to fight. It is an amazing story.
Jay, as a history buff, I mean, how much of this musical is about Albert and his issues with gender, and how much of it is a story about the Civil War?
You know, I tried to combine a little bit of both, Justin. It was definitely a story that focused on Albert, but it also focuses not just even Albert's life, but also women, how they were treated back then, and just the tough aspects of being in the Civil War. It even addresses little things like, not little things, but side issues such as PTSD. Not a side issue in our life,
but
a side issue in terms of the play. And I think it touches on a lot of different issues. And hopefully people will see different things depending upon who it is in the audience. If you're a female in the audience, you might see Albert as a female who fought, but many people saw Albert as a male, and he believed he acted as a male and fought a tremendous war.
Well, one of the great, I mean, the way that the story plays out and the play and the way that you've written the musical and the play, is essentially the prosecution of him. This idea that, you know, they're going to prosecute him for impersonating a soldier.
Yeah.
You essentially could tell the stories of his heroism, his life as a soldier, the things that people remember. You can build a case for Albert by people essentially telling their story on the stand, or at least in a way of explaining it that Albert was not necessarily, you know, someone impersonating a soldier. He was a soldier.
Right. Well, as a lawyer, I felt that compelled, of course, to tell it that way. Albert's story is actually that he had several men who came back years later in 1913, several of his fellow comrades, who testified in his pension hearing. Really what the situation was is they wanted to take away his pension, and the government filed an action against him.
For impersonating
an officer. And brought up such things as the fact that he voted in three elections, and that was an outrage because it was a woman voting, so to speak, and that he held a bank account. And, you know, women weren't allowed to hold bank accounts. But, you know, the important thing is Albert continued to say, "I'm Albert D.J. Cashier. I am who I am." In other words, he lived and believed and fought as a man, and I think he should have been respected as that. And all of these soldiers came back and they testified for him. And it's that's the most powerful piece of the story that I loved and I loved writing about.
The musical is called The Civility of Albert Cashier. It's on stage through October 15th at Stage 773 in studio of the playwright Jay Gerritani. Jay, you are a lawyer. I mean, it's interesting today as I did a little bit of research on you. I was like, oh, I'm like, there's two Jay Gerritanis. That's great. There's the playwright. And then there's the lawyer. I mean, what is it about writing plays that draws you to it with a legal background?
Well, I'm a trial lawyer, and if you think about it, a trial is a production as well. You are a producer, you're a writer, you have actors, so to speak, and the only difference is you have 12 people in the audience instead of, and we hope to have a little bit more than that at the show, and they don't get to vote you out, you know, they don't get to say yes or no.
That would be a good play, though. The audience gets to judge at the end what they thought, right?
Oh, yeah, right.
You're onto something.
I think they have some of those shows, right? America's Got Talent like that. But, you know, and I've fought different battles in courts. I've had court battles about transgender individuals. I fought for a young kid who was a transgender student back 10, 15 years ago. We lost that case because the appellate court didn't want to give him the right to be homeschooled because he was bullied. I think it was the wrong decision. But, you know, I've continued to fight those battles and really appreciated it. And then having the opportunity to tell this story was really went along with my career.
Yeah, and going back to the issue at hand about Albert Cashier being born a woman, I mean, are you attracted? I mean, you mentioned at the top, you're attracted to it because you are a history buff, and it is an interesting story, especially as we talk about how it's playing out right now in the current political climate.
Right.
But how much of it is also based on the personal part of being a trial lawyer, being involved in these cases, and having a personal understanding of the issue?
That certainly played a role. And also, the LGBT community has even failed to recognize oftentimes, or the LGB community has failed to recognize the T or the trans individuals in society. I think while the boat's been lifted for a lot of gay individuals and lesbian individuals, a lot of trans individuals have not been in that boat and they've been discriminated against in horrible ways. I mean, there was just, I think I read a few weeks ago about a death of another trans individual or trans teens and teen individual. And you know, it saddens me, and especially in this climate. And I saw a post recently about a young soldier who, you know, looked like a tough guy, handsome, fought, and he's willing to fight for us, right? He's willing to go to war and die, give the ultimate sacrifice. And I just feel strongly that if that's the case, how dare we as a government say you can't serve in our military?
Are you surprised both in your life as a lawyer, but also in your life as an artist and a playwright, that this is an issue in 2017, that the current administration is taking this stance about transgendered and trans individuals in the military?
Yeah, I thought that we got beyond it. I thought a few years ago when Obama passed the or wrote the executive order allowing trans individuals to serve in military, and there's some, what did you say, to 8 or 10,000 individuals,
yeah,
you hear different statistics. But those people are human beings who want to fight for our country. I mean, I don't think many people, including, maybe this is wrong to say in your show, but Donald Trump didn't want to serve. He had a deferment. And yet, you know, individuals are out there volunteering to serve. And if we go to war with North Korea, if we go to war with Syria or any other country, they're going to be there on the front lines. And you're going to dehumanize these people? You're going to minimize their contribution by saying, no, you can't serve and you have to leave? I just think that that's an outrage. It isn't what our country stands for.
And a country in which this has already been played out. I mean, the story of Albert Cashier is a telling one from the Civil War from hundreds of years ago.
Right.
This idea that that's already kind of played out in a way.
Yeah, and you would expect that type of conduct during the Civil War days or the early 1900s because, you know, there was a lot more prejudice at that time. But, you know, in the last 6 months or so, we've just seen this recurrence of prejudice against all sorts of individuals, whether it's people of color, it's trans individuals, and it seems to be rearing its ugly head again. And yeah, I'm disappointed that that's not behind us. I really thought it would be.
The musical is called The Civility of Albert Cashier. It's on stage at State 773 in Lakeview through October 15th. Why a musical? I mean, you know, let's talk about the play. I mean, there's one thing about to be able to tell the story, and I think it could be told in words, but this is being told in music as well.
Well, I got to be honest with you, Justin. I didn't decide on the musical. I got to give credit to Keaton Wooden and Joe Stevens. Joe Stevens is a trans individual who actually played with, I'm going to forget the name of the group, the Indigo Girls, or played, you know, warmed up with them or played with them in some capacity. A brilliant artist, really a great folk singer and rock folk singer, and Keaton's a great director, and it was his decision. I wrote it as a play, and I don't have that much musical talent myself, and I think I was kicked out of drum school when I was a kid. So one day we had coffee, and he said, what are you working on? And he was working on some things. I said, well, I'm working on this play, and you know, I think I'm pretty much done with it, and I'm going to submit it and see how it goes. And he said, could I take a look at it? And Keaton called me a week later. He said, what do you think if we made it into a musical? And I said, musical? I said, well, you better get some folks to help write this music because and write the notes because I don't know how to write the musical notes. And he and I and Joe did write a lot of the lyrics together, although I got to give them the lion's share of the credit. And they wrote the music itself. I mean, my only job was to annoy them and say, I want to hear more rock or I want to hear more violin or this or that.
Yeah, right.
But they really did a great job. And we just got a review, and the review of the music has been tremendous. So it's also a fun play. I mean, if you want to listen to some fun music, and it's got folk, it's got a lot of guitar in it, it's got some rock in it, it's a little bit different.
The musical is The Civility of Albert Cashier. It's on stage at Stage 773 right there in Belmont in Lakeview, on stage through October 15th. It tells the story of Civil War soldier Albert Cashier, who was born a woman, keeps it a secret, fights in the Civil War, is a war hero. As he is growing older, his secret is revealed, and the United States, the military, they essentially prosecute him for impersonating a soldier, and that's a story. It's a true story of Albert Cashier, which is on stage at State 773. The playwright is Jay Deratani. Jay, thanks so much for being here. Really appreciate you telling the story.
Justin, thank you for having me here.
Coming up, we're playing the worst. 312-981-7200. Rena Kalm and Kyle Scanlon will be our panel tonight. Very excited to have them both in studio where you complain about the worst things in society for prizes. As we mentioned, we're going to Berwyn on Friday. I gotta get working on getting that show together, huh? You can't fault me at all for the amount of preparation that went into tonight's show. I mean, we're talking about, at the beginning of the show, 7:30, we had a business segment in which we talked with the CEO of Portillo's about their expansion plans. 8 o'clock, Eve Ewing. and her debut album. We talked about identity, race, poetry. Then a little a quaint segment about fixing racism, Reverend Ken Bedell. And then, you know, just a throwaway segment about transgendered in the military. So a full show tonight. Tomorrow I get on Berwyn to knock it out the park.
Well, the mayor's coming.
Awesome.
I know that for sure.
There you go. By the way, oh, thank you for reminding me. Have you seen the billboards and the commercials for the new show, The Mayor, on ABC?
I have.
It's about a kid who's a, I'm not sure what the full summary of it is.
Hip-hop kid?
He's a hip-hopper who becomes the mayor. That's my idea.
You had that.
I don't want to get into a back-and-forth match with old Hollywood, right? But I had an idea, which is on paper.
Oh, yeah. You have a
and
case.
And I pitched it. I've pitched it. I pitched it to producers in Hollywood probably about 5-6 years ago. You know, I didn't really have a good name for it, but I called it Hip-Hop Alderman, right? And it was based on Rhymefest running for mayor, right? Remember we did that? Well, I went in and I talked to some people, you know, some nice couches, sparkling water, the whole bit, right? A lot of headsets out in the lobby area. Real happy to talk with me. We're definitely doing business. Definitely. Oh, this is great. And then you never hear from him again. The premise I had, which is a better premise than what they're doing, is the hip-hop guy runs for mayor to sell his record, and he wins. So what's he going to do now? What? Right?
Uh-huh.
Mine was, you get a guy like Kanye West. I think it was kind of built, the prototype was on Kanye West, who's a huge megastar, to the point where he's at stadiums and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
He gets a call because he's from Chicago, South Sider, and his family is a political family. His dad, kind of like a Harold Washington type, has fallen ill. He comes back to Chicago to his old ward. His dad dies, right? And he realizes how important his dad was to this community, and he takes over. And so Kanye decides to be an alderman in the 20th Ward as opposed to creating his career. So he's still got his posse around him, and they don't know what to do. That's the comic effect, you know, like the idea. But he's like the lowest of the low politician, like in charge of making sure people's garbage gets picked up. That was what I was going for, right?
That's a really good idea.
Hey. Well, it's gone now. The mayor, the same concept. There's not going to be a spinoff. Maybe it was the name. I need a better name than the Hip Hop Alderman. Might have phoned it in on the name for that sitcom.
Well, I don't think that's your job necessarily. I think they could massage that. But the idea.
It's good, right?
Oh man.
Maybe I should write a film. Maybe it should be a film.
Can I be the bumbling white reporter that follows him around? From like meeting to meeting,
you're the muckraker.
Totally, no, I'd love that.
Yeah,
to be honest,
we'll just do it ourselves. We'll do an indie version. We'll just cut a sizzle reel. We'll send it back in, and we'll be like, "Hey, man, the guys, Esmeralda's in it." We'll do a whole thing where it's just like the Download presents Hip Hop Alderman.
I want to be the snarky secretary.
You guys, we're writing this. We don't even need to run a script.
Yeah. Esmeralda would be like the gatekeeper, and I could always be trying to get I really need to talk to him.
You guys,
I don't think so.
All right, we'll see about that.
Yeah,
right. I mean, it writes itself.
This is genius.
I think so. I think it was on its way. On its way.
I really think you have some sort of case if you have this. If you
I do,
presented
I have it on.
This
I have it. I have it on.
Is this like trademarked and everything?
You can't really.
Or whatever the.
Yeah, but we have. I have a letterhead that has like the logo. And I have like, because what Schadenfreude did is we created, you know, we had 5 or 7 pitches that you'd go into a meeting and be like, oh, here's the pitches. And that was one of them. And that was the one I always had a smile on my face. I spent 20 minutes too long on a 20-minute story at one time in an Endeavor meeting. That's Ari Emanuel's place, talking about how someone should do the Todd Stroger movie. Right, because when Todd Stroger was the Cook County Board President, and I was in there, I was like, what's happening right now? Make that movie. And they're like, nope, sounds good. This is Tyler. This is Kyle. This is Eric. And this is John. They're going to be your agents. I'm like, oh, my gosh. I got to pay like 90% of my money to these guys. So Yeah, so Hip Hop Alderman. I'll find it. I'll find the pitch. How about that? Tomorrow night, I'll if we have time.
For Swap Me, all your old pitches.
Who would like, how much is my Hip Hop Alderman pitch worth? All right. Coming up, the worst.
It's going down, y'all.
All right, it's time to play the worst. 312-981-7200. This is where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes, and we've got them tonight. I love this one, and it keeps popping up, and I think it's probably the coolest prize of all time. A 3-month semi-private training membership, including unlimited training every day at Redline Athletics in Buffalo Grove. So you can essentially win. You could complain about something in society and get a gym membership out of it. It's pretty awesome, right?
I think we're just promoting complaining now.
Yeah, right? I mean, it works. I'd be like, I'd save all my complaints for Tuesday night if I knew I was going to get something out of it.
Is it semi-private, like you're the only one who's exercising but anybody can watch?
I think it is. Rena Kalm in studio along with Kyle Scanlon. They are our panel tonight. Rena can be seen, and she's a regular here. Good to see you.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
You can see her Top 10 Tuesdays at the Laugh Factory every Tuesday night at 9:30, except for right now. Also, and this is a treat, and you're going to be in Cincinnati at the club Go Bananas.
That is true.
Thursday through Sunday. I only say that because WGN reaches Ohio.
Yeah, come
on. So it could be
out.
People in the Ohio area. Go see Rena and Cincinnati at Go Bananas.
Yes, please.
How great is that?
I love it there. It's a cool little place.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I've never been to Cincinnati.
It's like right next to Kentucky, so you're like, you know, people are like, but it's not.
That's just what it says when you come into Cincinnati.
Or Indiana. It's like a very nice.
We're not Kentucky.
I don't know. They're really excited about it. That's them, not me.
There you go. Kyle Scanlon, he does Upstand Comedy Thursday nights at the Comedy Bar right here downtown.
Yeah.
Also, Lincoln Lodge at Under the Gun Theater, which is great. What a great thing to take over, the Under the Gun Theater.
Started last week.
And it's Friday nights?
Yeah, Friday night and Saturday night, but I'm on the Friday.
All right, Friday night. All right, let's play the worst. 312-981-7200. We'll start tonight the way we start every night with Pete Zimmerman. Pete, you're up.
You know what's the worst?
What's the worst, Pete?
When you accidentally double how are you somebody. I was working over the weekend in a booth, you know, and people are coming in and they go, hey, you know, or you greet them first. Hey, how are you? And they say, I'm fine. Good. How are you? And then you go, oh, I'm great. How are you? Have you been in that situation?
I have.
The worst. Yeah. The double how are yous.
I had a strange interaction the other day with a friend I'd ran into in Walgreens, and I hadn't seen her in a while. And I go, I don't know why I said it, but I go, you look good. And she was like, yeah, thanks. And then
compared
when we were leaving,
what?
And then she's leaving, I go, you look good. Like it was like,
you said it twice.
I said it twice.
That's like almost so like doing the wave at the wrong person, and you're like, hi, oh, just kidding. Yeah. I was just stretching.
I'm not even sure what I was, I don't know. It didn't go unnoticed. Let's just put that. She was like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm just trying to come up with something. It's not how are you.
Yeah.
You're just standing there with a shovel.
Can you say,
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Can you say, you look well?
You look well.
Is that...
It's all cleared up.
Everybody's like, what are you looking at?
You
know? Yeah.
All right, Rena, what's the worst?
Oh, you know what my new thing is that I just cannot handle is people following too close on the highway. I know that's like a thing that's like a law or whatever that you're not supposed to do.
You're not into
do.
The close.
I drive a lot, okay? And it has been an issue. And my main thing is that like... what's the worst is that I can't let myself flip people off anymore.
Yeah, you're done with the I think the worst is the flip off.
Really? Well,
you think that's worse?
I think it's worse. Yeah, I think we're at a point in society where there's just no place for the flip off. It needs to go away.
I don't know. A really powerful one feels good sometimes, but let me know if you think this is worse or better, is what I've traded in the flip off for is a very passive aggressive thumbs up, psycho.
Well, see, sarcastic is good.
Yeah,
sarcastic,
that's more fun.
Yeah, that's more fun. The flip off, you're just like, what's going on?
Yeah.
Like that is a signal that is essentially the worst thing you could say to somebody. So what am I supposed to do with that?
Well, just so you know, I preface the flip-off move. I don't just dive into that. That's intense. I will first tap on my brakes a little, be like, hey, buddy, you know what you're doing back there is not cool. And then they come flying by me because they know, oh, yeah, I'm following too close.
And,
and then I'm like, I flip them one. But you know what? Not anymore. Has somebody threw condiment packets at my car and tried to run me off the road one time for doing that.
See? Because you gave them nowhere to go.
You're right.
If you would have went with a thumbs up, sarcastic, they're like, oh, she's okay. She's being
smart. She's got issues.
She's being smart.
Okay. You're right. No, I've learned my lesson. So I talked about something that's the worst for me, and I've changed the way in which I was the worst.
Yeah. God, you've grown so much.
I have I've told this story on the show, but the when I was in high school, I was going to turnabout dance and took the lovely lady, Melissa Potts, with me. She asked me. It was one of those things. Turnabout.
How does she look now? Does she look well?
I know. She looks good. She looks really good. So on the way home, I was driving her back to McCollum Lake, and someone was right on my tail, just like you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I went to the flip-off, and then the cherries went on.
Oh,
and it was a police officer who had pulled me over for essentially nothing. He was just trailing to see what he had.
Oh,
that's how you do it in the rural towns.
Yeah.
Just troll till someone makes a mistake. And my mistake is I flipped him off. So I didn't get a ticket because what are you going to get? What's the law that I broke? And he essentially said, you're just going to cause domestic situations with that kind of behavior.
I mean, it seems like what you got instead of a ticket was a lifetime fear.
Yeah.
Flipping the bird.
Yeah.
You know what,
so
I will say? Flipping the bird never looks good in front of someone else. Because I mean, your passenger, if they flip off someone on your behalf, you're like, hey, thanks, man. But if you flip off somebody and somebody's in the car, they're like, whoa.
Oh, and imagine, the dance didn't go that great. And now we're pulled over because I flipped off a cop.
It's a
cool story, but needless to say, Melissa and I did not work out.
Her girlfriends, though, that like, hey, it didn't work out because he flipped off a cop.
Yeah.
Like, that's
bad boy behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like you throw on a leather jacket, you got yourself a new date the next day.
That's true.
Honestly, yeah, that says more about her.
Yeah, once that story hit the hallways of the school, man, did that reputation just fly off the shelves. All right, Kyle, what do you got for the worst?
Put a leash on your dog. Just, I don't know your dog. Yeah. I don't trust your dog.
Yeah.
It's a law. Just put a leash on it. I don't care if it's a good boy or a good girl. Like, just put a leash on it. I don't want it to get up on me and like with its dirty paws. And you're like, oh no, it's a good dog. I'll be the judge of that.
Yeah.
Put it on a leash. I'll judge it from afar.
We could judge it like pageant style.
Yeah.
If you have a leash.
What
sit,
is the world
paw.
Coming to? We're like talking about things. People are just straight up breaking laws out there.
Yeah.
We're like, hey, you know what's the worst is not following the rules, dum-dum. Yeah.
I like that. I don't know if you're a good girl. I don't know if you're a good boy.
I have no idea. I don't want to find out.
I'll find out with Alicia.
Yeah.
We'll go through like a sobriety test with this dog. Find out. I'll for myself make that judgment. All right. Kyle Scanlon, Rena Kalm in studio. Here's what we're going to do. We'll take a quick break. We come back. I got a ton of texts. I got people on the line, Frank and Kim. So let's keep them coming. 312-981-7200. Stay with us.
What's going down?
Kyle Scanlon, Rena Kalm in studio. We're playing the worst. 312-981-7200. Wow, we got a lot of texts, a lot of calls. So why don't we get right to it tonight? We are complaining about the worst things in society for prizes. Frank, why don't you kick it off tonight? What's the worst, Frank?
The worst is being a Cub fan, but having several brothers and brother-in-laws who are all Sox fans, and they all get good tickets to the game from jobs they have, but they never bring me.
Oh, I just got sad at the end. I thought I was going to go in a different direction, but
that is
the worst because they write you off because you're a Cubs fan.
They're going there to, you know, hoping the Cubs will lose, and they're sitting right behind home plate, and I'm sitting at home listening to it on the radio.
Oh,
so you're talking Cubs Sox when they play each other.
No, I'm talking about any Cub game. They get
the Cubs tickets, but they're Sox fans.
I go to Wrigley Field all the time. I never get to go.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Frank.
You should try getting a job down on the South Side and see if you can get free Sox tickets.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. You just pay them back with their own medicine.
Exactly.
Or just go on StubHub with like $12 and get Sox tickets.
That's true.
Yeah.
That is true. All right. Thanks, Frank.
Okay. Bye.
That is true. Or you do what I do at Sox Park, is you get the $5 ticket, and then just systemically you could just every 5 minutes get to the first row.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't care. You're just like, it's kind of like a lobster in a boiling pot. You just every ball thrown to home plate, you just move up a seat.
And everybody's squealing.
And nobody cares. Like, you're just like, and I think it helps because somewhere in Sox Park at like the fourth or fifth inning, they do the T-shirt cannon stuff. And then they have people who throw T-shirts, but it only goes to like the first four or five rows. And those are unoccupied. So I feel like I'm doing a service for the complexes of those people who have to throw those things. Now that someone's like, they feel good about it.
You're making the TV broadcast look better.
Right.
Too.
Yeah.
I wish comedy was like that, where people would just like voluntarily move up close. You know?
Yeah. That's the other way around, right?
People don't do that at all.
Yeah, that's right. All right, let's go to Kim. Kim, what's the worst, Kim?
Hi, guys. Well, I had to think about this one because I had a lot of driving ones. I spent a lot of time commuting. Mm-hmm. But I guess this week I just caught up on my Instagram feed. Mm-hmm. And people who I thought were sane and reasonable posting images of 9/11, insisting it was a conspiracy theory.
That is the worst.
Perpetuated by the Federal Reserve or God knows. My mouth just dropped today.
It's
when I read that, I thought, it's been 16 years, really?
Well, what I would say to that, and thanks, Kim, for that. Appreciate it. For me, there's a time and a place for 9/11 conspiracy theories, and that would be
any other day than
9/11, right? That's where you're going to plant your flag on the idea that, oh, it's an anniversary. I got this great theory I learned from YouTube. Go away.
Yeah.
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 We don't have any new discoveries.
Yeah. Your source is YouTube.
Yeah.
If that,
you watched a guy get hit in the nuts before.
Hey, listen, say what you will about YouTube conspiracies. Nicki Minaj has lizard eyeballs, okay? I don't know if you've ever watched that video of her blinking, but they don't move like that if you're a human.
Right.
Okay.
There you go. I knew she wasn't human from her verse on Monster. But
yes.
I knew that. It was inhuman.
Let's talk about the real
Jay-Z
stuff.
She did.
Yes.
All right, here we go. You ready? We got good stuff. All right. 773 says, you know, it's the worst being in a coffee shop today. Parents buy a sprinkled donut for their 3-year-old. Okay, good start. Who's super excited. As he eats the donut, they encourage him to share, but he refuses. When he's not looking, the parents eat the rest of the donut and the kid has a meltdown.
I love those parents.
So many things are wonderful and terrible.
Look over there. Yeah. Is that Barney?
Oh, my gosh. Imagine them at home. They're like hostages in their own home, you know?
I know. That's tough.
They have to like sneak food
away from
there.
A lot of sneaking around to get that 3-year-old to think about his life. Six.
Do you want to share? No? All right. Well, it's going to be forced upon you.
Get ready for the forced share. 608, the worst when someone is excited to see you, greeting you by name, and you can't remember who they are
or
how you
time.
Know them. The last time it happened to me, I said, hey, remind me how to spell your last name again. And he replied, S-M-I-T-H. That's a good one, right?
That's a good one, but it will bite you around.
Yeah, how do you spell that? That's hilarious.
That's like right out of a sitcom. I feel like I'm going to be watching The Goldbergs later tonight, and I'll see that joke, and I'll be like, you just lifted that. That's a great joke, right?
I might lift it.
Yeah,
I was going to say, the comics are...
Yeah.
Their minds are thinking right now. Okay, the 312 says the worst is the CCC, the canine cone collar. The poor dogs look like Trump built a wall around their heads.
I mean, but that's like to keep them from...
Yeah, so they don't bite like their wounds.
I mean, I'm sure it's the worst for them, but they also don't remember things after 2 seconds, right?
Yeah.
So maybe that's even worse if they keep realizing they're in a cone, you know? I don't know.
It's like the force share, you know?
Yeah.
You may not like it at first, but it's good for you.
It is. And when you're an adult, you're going to love the force share.
Yeah.
Like you learn. It's going to be such a painful experience when you have to share something and you're like, this is not out of love. This is out of some sort of weird behavioral thing I was taught when I was 3.
I'm going to have a meltdown right now.
Yeah. 708 says the worst is the double handshake.
The double handshake? That's a real power move.
Was that like 2 hands on the one hand?
I mean, I feel like I kind of respect anybody that's trying to put their own twist on it. You know what I mean?
But 2 hands at once? I mean, what are you talking about?
I like 2 hands at once. I want
left
and right. That's great.
That's my new move, I think.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
That would set you apart.
Cross arms and then start spinning.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Yeah, so you're onto something.
Cross arms and like do-si-do out of there.
708 says, you should have told the cop, back in my flip-off story, you should have told the cop that he looks good. What does that mean?
It's your move. Like,
yeah, that's your move. Yeah. You look good.
Yeah, you look good.
Oh, that would be, no, I got it. I got it. They brought it
I feel like that would not have gone well.
Yeah.
Like,
or maybe too well.
Or you would have run that town by now, is
right
the
now,
truth.
Yeah,
you know?
Mayor of McCollum Lake.
They're shooting Wire season 6 there.
It's like all that it took, you know?
All right. The worst is having an online long-distance relationship. Met a guy, great guy, on a dating website. We text and talk throughout the day. Bummer, we are a six-hour drive apart.
Yeah, I mean...
Oof, that is the worst.
Worst, I mean, bummer good, when good. You meet them and they're not...
I don't know. I would say 6 hours is a pretty... If it's like 3, that's way more obligation. Because it's like, it's just kind of down the street, babe, you know? But yeah, six hours is like... I mean, date somebody else, but it's not.
It's tough. I mean, you got a good connection. At least you got a connection there.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't have that connection.
No,
so.
I know. It's I don't date anybody to save myself these troubles, but.
That's your dating philosophy. Yeah. You're like, no, I don't date at all.
Oh, that seems like a lot of.
That's a lot of work. A lot of driving. And then
a lot of flipping off. I don't know. I don't really.
773 says the absolute worst. Is when you look out your back door and you're confronted by two big bushy skunks looking back at you with evil in their skunk eyes, just waiting for you to make a sudden move so they can stink you up with their funky smell. Wow, that sounds terrible.
Very descriptive,
very unique
event.
Yeah,
I feel like we got some anti-skunk propaganda coming up.
Pro-skunk guys are going to come out in a second.
Oh, they're going to come out of the woodwork.
Yeah.
If you see it, it's very upsetting because you know what's about to happen. If you kind of catch a whiff, you're like, oh, who's smoking? You know what I mean? But that's like a whole other thing.
But if you see, I don't think I've ever been in a situation where I've stared down a skunk.
Yeah, that's kind of a scary, because like it's going to happen right while it's going to spray you.
What do you do? Yeah.
I've been so afraid of that. If you get sprayed with a skunk, don't you have to take like a
tomato bath?
Yeah, or something
that. That's your biggest fear?
That sounds gross.
My biggest fear is a tomato bath.
I would hate that. I would hate that.
Yeah, I guess.
Just like all that tomato, grilled cheese.
All that no grilled cheese. Also, think about like the cleanup. Like, who wants to clean their tub? It's like people complain about lice. It's like... It's a lot of cleaning, too.
Yeah, a lot of things going on.
Nobody thinks about the chores.
Nobody thinks about the tomato bath.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, you don't want to go to the grocery store and say, how much of this V8 is it going to take to clean me? Yeah. So weird.
Maybe that's the little, the recipe on the back of the V8. How many does it take to...
I have a jacuzzi tub. How many cans would you recommend?
Oh, man, there's
cans?
A lot going
on. Can get the cans, I think. I think they used to have those, like the big giant cans.
I feel like there's probably a website for this. Like you can get industrial-sized tomato soup or whatever it is.
We didn't even finish reading the message. She's like, the skunks were rabid. And
yeah, we don't care. We're stuck on it.
And then they talked about V8 for 3 minutes.
Yeah. 708 says, the worst is when I go to the organic gardening website, and after 2 comments, the discussion turns political, and it's either Trump or Obama's fault that my tomatoes won't open. Or ripen, well, ripen.
I would say pick new websites.
I love that. I want to see that site. Something wrong with my tomatoes? Well, I'll tell you what the problem is.
I'll tell you what's important. If we don't get those tomatoes to open, how am I going to get a tomato tub for my skunk problem?
Exactly.
We got to get into it.
We're back to that problem.
We're not going to get past that one tonight. 312-981-7200. Kyle Scanlon, Rena Kalm in studio tonight. Oh, we will take a quick break, get update on tonight's news, and we'll do second half of the worst coming up. Stay with us. All right. Thanks, Rob. It's the worst here on the download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Playing the worst, where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. We've got pizza and gym memberships. And Jamie Farr. Jamie Farr, there's a show. I lost the sheet. It's in front of me somewhere here. I got it. Tonight, one of the prizes is a pair of tickets to see MASH star Jamie Farr at the Max Center. He's in Tuesdays with Maury.
Oh.
On September 30th. Wow.
Where's that?
The Max Center is out at DuPage, College of DuPage. So is Glen Ellen.
I like MASH, but in my head it's still, I think I'm just like, I was born a little after the show. So for me, it's that game of you decide mansion, apartment,
yep.
shack or house.
Just so, that little hand thing that you keep moving over and over again.
That's great. Rena Kallman studio. She can be seen at the Top 10 Tuesday show every Tuesday at the Laugh Factory, 9:30, except for tonight. And also in Cincinnati this weekend, Thursday through Sunday, at Go Bananas.
Yeah, you know it.
You know it. So everyone out in Kentucky and Ohio and that area, go see Rena at the Go Bananas. Kyle Scanlon does Upstand Comedy every Thursday at the Comedy Bar. Also does shows at Lincoln Lodge, the Underground Theater, Friday night.
Yeah.
This is coming up here.
Come see us.
All right, so let's keep going here. The worst, 630 says, the worst is walking down a narrow sidewalk or an aisle in a building towards a couple who are walking while holding hands.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And they defiantly refuse to get over, like they are insecurely permanently attached.
Hell no.
Pathetically, older couples do this often.
I play this game of chicken every day. Because I'm kind of like a bigger dude, and I just refuse to, like, if just get out of the way. Get out of the way, or I'm going to shoulder check you.
Yes, I'm lonely and bitter, but I will say, why don't we use sidewalks like I do my taxes, single file, okay? That is not okay.
Can that joke be on the worst?
That's a good joke. That's a good joke.
That's so good.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
I mean it.
847 says, you know what's even worse? Having skunks in the winter under your front porch. The whole house smelled awful till we got them trapped.
Oh, no.
We were going to breakfast at Panera and people were looking at me, realized I smelled of it too.
Imagine what it's like to be a skunk and everybody just looks at you like, ew.
I know. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I had some friends who were working at a station in town and they had like a animal segment. You know, and so like some exotic animal segment like you would see on the Tonight Show, but it's here in Chicago. And the best part was that it's just every person on Instagram had to post that they were holding a skunk, but it was the skunk was de-smelled or whatever.
Is that Chicago exotic? Is that the best we can do?
That's exactly what
it was. It's like a Bengal tiger for us.
And every person's like, can I hold it? Can you take this picture? Can you? Great. Can you take the animal? Great. Thank you. Can
I'm gonna
I have this
lift
picture?
Its tail up?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I mean, it couldn't have been like my Instagram feed was like, you like skunks. Yeah. Like it was like seven pictures of the same skunk being held by seven different people.
Then all of a sudden you're getting sponsored ads for like Old Spice.
For tomato baths.
Yeah, or tomato baths.
Right. Who someone texted and said it's a myth.
Yeah, we're having a lot of conspiracy theories about a lot of things right now.
Right, and there you go.
I'd say equally.
331 says, the worst are people who put police badges right on their license plates. Do they think it's a get-out-of-a-ticket card? And if so, how do you get one? That's like when you give money to the police union.
Yeah. I had one on my first car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the idea, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the idea is that you gave money, they called you, and you said, you know, I'll give you $25, and can I have that decal?
And then you put it on there, and then you go, ah.
And then you think everything's cool, right?
I want a vanity plate that says, I'm a cop, as I want to beat the system. But also, here's what I do on that note. Sometimes I'll make deliveries, so sometimes I just leave my delivery thing in the car in case it's kind of like not the legalist parking spot. I'm like, but I might be bringing somebody there. I'm not. But I also keep in my car a receipt from one time I donated food, like, probably a year ago now, just in case, like, I feel like, oh, well, if somebody, like, pulls me over, be like, look, I'm a good person.
Don't look at the date.
Just going through the glove compartment, like, just grabbing whatever old receipt you have. Look, this is, I'm trying to, this is my case.
I'm a good person.
A good case.
Oh, my top fell off. Look, I'm a good person.
I had a turkey sub six times last week. Don't look at all the receipts.
All right. The worst is when you're at a restaurant and the parents are on their phones and the kids are running amok.
Mm.
We get that one every week. That's a systemic societal problem.
Yeah. That's rough.
Isn't it weird to see how many couples go out to eat now and they just both stare at their phones like the entire meal?
I saw a family.
It looks great.
Where the kid was hitting his mother over the head with an iPad while she was ordering and she was just unfazed, just kept ordering. Oh. And that was happening the whole time.
Motherhood.
Yeah.
That could be a Saturday Night Live parody commercial about the beauties of motherhood by getting pounded on the head by an iPad.
Yeah. Yikes. It's not. That's where we are, you know?
Yeah.
That's where we are.
That's where we're at.
We made it.
630 Mary from Roselle says, during practice, here's the worst. During practice, before league bowling, you're getting all strikes. During real play, barely get one per game.
Hmm.
That's a brag.
That's a real, yeah. Well, yeah, it's a couple things.
A little humble
but
brag.
You know, I thought it was like, she was saying, I only hit one pin, but she's saying one strike.
Oh, that's what she was saying?
She's saying, yeah.
I'm nearly illiterate, so.
she might as well have said, during practice, I'm getting a 250, and now I'm just getting a 180.
That's like when you're like, hey, my car's been making a sound, and you're getting an oil change. You're like, hey, just so you know, like, this car's been doing this thing. And they're like, it absolutely isn't. You're like, I swear, but it doesn't do it when they look. And
and then you throw a bowling ball at it.
You just try to break your car to prove yourself right. Be like, I told you.
Right. 630 says the worst is being inside someone's house for a service call and then a dog pees on your tool bag first thing in the morning.
No.
That's terrible. That's the worst. Any time you come in to do any work and the house attacks you, that's no good.
Yeah, I guess I'm not used to doing service. And well, that's not true. I've like nannied and stuff, but you expect them to pee on you.
That's like part of it, I think.
Yeah, it's like cool. You're like chill with the vomit.
For that.
Yeah.
Oh, I've been initiated in.
Yeah. You're like, only once?
What, do you not love me?
All right, keep going. 847, the worst when the weather person uses, quote, potentially severe or heavy winds or damaging hail and it drizzles.
I would love a weatherman that's like, I guess we'll see what happens, huh?
Yeah. Just a weatherman that shoots dice and is just like,
it's time for our segment. Roll the dice.
Cloudy and...
It's got little decals on it. It's like cloudy, thunder, and just a dice. That'd be a great bit. That's a good bit.
Or you tell me, I'm inside.
Exactly. I'm guilty of this. I used this earlier in the show when we talk about phrases. I the worst for me is the phrase, in this political climate.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear it constantly. I've heard it over and over and over. And I did it tonight when I was talking, I think it was to Jay, the playwright. I was like, well, in this political like I was in the middle of saying it, and I was like, can't get out of this phrase. But that phrase is ridiculous. What do you mean, in this political climate? You mean politics?
I mean, if we can call it that anymore.
Yeah. The season of The Princess is very weird.
Ever since the portal opened. I don't know.
Yeah. All right. 312-981-7200. All right. Let's see. 847 says the iPad commercial idea should be a condom commercial.
Hmm.
Like you hit that the kid's hitting you with the iPad.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Now I remember the thing I just said. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, that's smart.
Yeah. There you go.
Or just a picture of a
nobody's
kid in
talking
general.
About the wait. I want to say, you know what's, you know, the person who's saying people who bring their kids to the restaurant, they're annoyed. Think about that server.
Yeah.
That server, nothing is more annoying to me than making your server literally wait on you. Like, you know, we're not sure. We're still looking. What do you like? Like, to their kids. And then there's a person making minimum wage just like standing there smiling for as long as it takes for you to get.
Going to get your kids under control.
Yeah. Mm. We have fun.
847. The worst is I drive for a rideshare company in the city. The worst is when I'm just pulling up to wherever to pick someone up and they cancel the ride.
Oh, man.
Did they take a look and see if maybe you're one of those drivers that just tries to make small talk with people the whole way there? Because maybe that's why they canceled.
They quickly Googled you and they figured out that you were a small talker.
Yeah.
And they're like, I'm out.
Sometimes it's like it's a whoopsie for them, too, because I was just hanging out in New York with a bunch of friends and
we'll bite. What's going on? You're New York. Cool.
Yeah. Well,
oh yeah.
They got black. They could have happened anywhere. Only in New York. This could have happened anywhere.
Hey,
they,
I'm walking here.
They blacked out. Wow. New York. they blacked out and they ended up canceling over the course of the night, like 5 or 10 Ubers. And
what?
The only communication they had was at one point one of them tried texting them and the girlfriend just wrote back, I'm sorry? ? And they were blacked out. I mean, sometimes it's like not a
blacked
slight.
Out drunk? What do you mean? So the passengers that they
were
trying to pick
up. Yeah, so I'm saying maybe they canceled because they're like
drunk.
Wasted and they don't know what they're doing. It's just unfortunate that the person who's driving, and this is the worst, that driver doesn't get anything for showing up that far. Because I think the customer for canceling still gets charged a nominal
$5.
Fee. Yeah, so like, because I do delivery sometimes on an app like that too for Postmates. And
in New York?
In New York, in Detroit, just kidding, they don't have it. In St.
They
Louis,
go bananas this
in Atlanta.
So you do the show in Cincinnati, and then during the day, you're like, I'll just deliver some stuff.
Yeah, I'll go. I delivered coffee to the mayor of Denver. Comedy's going fine, but delivery-wise, I am crushing it in that town.
love it. 312-981-7200. The worst is opening. Okay, here we go. Ooh, 708. The worst is opening up the garage. I'm sorry, the garbage can for yard waste to find that hornets have made a nest inside and you're highly allergic.
Oh, no.
Any suggestions would be appreciated. Oh, what? This is not a home improvement show.
I barely graduated high school. Don't listen to what I have to say.
You should move.
Yeah. Burn that trash can.
They don't have hornets in New York. No, I'm just kidding. Man. They totally. So you live with them.
I think you go in. Yeah, you go in fighting.
They're in your bathtub. Swinging. Yeah.
I had the funniest where I had this. This happened to me last year. I hope it doesn't happen again. In like October, November, I started to see bees on the inside of my window, like moving really slow. Like I figured it out. We had Googled it and done everything. I think we talked about on the show that it was like that there's a nest probably in the wall, and when it gets cold outside, they essentially die, but it takes them a while to die. So they like they're grasping. So they come inside like, help me.
Oh, God.
Right? That kind of thing. So you just see the it's not moving. So it's an easy way to kill them. But my son, we're like, I'm like, stay away from there, blah, blah, blah.
Did you give him an iPad to swat it with?
Yeah. No, that's what you got to do. This is what he did. This is crazy. It's like right where the TV was, where Wii U was playing it. He just kind of rolls over, and he got stung by a bee that was on the ground dying.
Oh, gosh. That's
like when he was like, oh, he's like, oh, and I'm like, what? No. Like, that's on you. Like,
yeah.
You can't roll, what are you rolling over for? Like, come on. Like, we real people, we have to deal with like fast moving, dive bombing bees that try to get you when you're not looking. He rolled over onto it. I was like, luckily he was not allergic, but I was like,
yeah,
hey, you learned your lesson. Don't be so lazy. Yeah. Stand
this is
up.
On you.
There's no need to roll over to get up. You could probably stand up like a human being.
Learned something. Just it's like you're flipping off learning right. of yeah. that lesson yeah. where it's like he's probably going to never roll over again in his life, you know?
That's right. 312-981-7200. Let's go ahead and do this. We'll take a break. We'll tally up what we have for the winners, see what else is coming in, 312-981-7200. And we will deliver some gifts. Maybe, Rena, you could deliver these prizes to people.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Just don't cancel before I get there.
There you go. Rena Call, Kyle Scanlon in studio. All right, we'll take a break. Stay with us. All right, we're wrapping up the worst tonight. 312-981-7200. Kyle Scanlon and Rena Calm in studio tonight. The worst, 773 says, is having your window open on a beautiful Chicago evening with the soft, cool breeze blowing in. And all of a sudden, a skunk walks by. What's with the skunks?
A lot of skunk stuff.
You get one skunk
it's
text,
the season?
And it's just, I think it just brings something out.
Yeah.
Sometimes it'll be like restaurants or restaurant experiences or the car experiences.
Yeah,
we got skunk tonight.
It's a theme.
There you go.
You never hear that at a restaurant. We got skunk tonight.
We got skunk tonight. 312. Here's a good one. 312 says, the worst are all my friends and all of my family for never giving me a surprise party.
Oh, man. I wish that there was no reason and it was just all my friends and all my family. You figure it out.
There was a early on, and I thought we had hit jackpot on this bit. We had done the worst, and it was like the first week, I think.
Yeah.
And it was hilarious because the text was 312 says the worst is tiny stores. And I was like, that's great. That's a winner. That's a great bit.
Yeah.
Right. And I didn't realize that they had done two texts. So it was tiny stores where, blah, and then they like made it not as great.
Oh, okay.
Whatever. But I just read tiny stores. And I was like, this is going to be the best segment ever. These people are so creative and clever.
Turns out no.
Yeah. But I just stayed with it. I was like, yeah, tiny stores. Oh, I was like, what a great worst. Tiny stores. Yeah. That's the worst.
Yeah, sure. Too small in here.
518, dropping something between the car gear shift and the side of the seat.
Oh, girl.
My fat fingers always get stuck at the knuckles.
I mean, is it your fingers? No, it's the worst. That is the worst.
Yeah.
Yeah, nobody likes that.
They tried to invent something to... Is that a real thing?
I don't know.
They tried to invent something?
Like a grabber
or something? Yeah, everything falls in there.
Like a bad infomercial?
I'm putting all these people at risk trying to do my makeup while I drive. Do I really need to drop my makeup while... You know what I mean? Like, that's just extra.
These deliveries aren't going to deliver themselves.
You're FaceTiming your friend while you're doing your makeup. I want to say the worst is the new craze I've seen, and I think I've mentioned this before too, but the public FaceTiming. While like you're in line at Dunkin' Donuts, someone is FaceTiming, having a conversation like in front of you going, oh, you know it. And you're like, well, no, we're not. I don't think we're there as a society.
Yeah.
That's not designed for this to be a public conversation.
Going live should be special, like from 10 to 11, being on The Worst with Justin Kaufman on WG. Like there should be like times that you like, hey, we're going live.
But yeah, right.
Most of the time, it's just going to be footage of the underneath of my chin while I'm trying to figure out what I just
the
pressed.
Idea that that's the mode of communication you've chosen.
Oh, yeah. To the FaceTime?
Yeah. The idea that that in that moment in your walk to and the loop to get back home and you're going to stop at the Dunkin' Donuts. So I haven't talked to Rena in a while. I'll FaceTime her. Maybe it's a generational thing. I don't know what it is, but I was like, I don't know, man. There's still some etiquette and some couthness. If that's even a word.
I mean, in this social climate, I feel like if you don't text me, are you a murderer? Like,
yeah, that's a thing. I don't want to hear someone's voice while alone, see their face. Like, right. Just text me.
Just DM me just on Instagram me. Or something I won't see for a month, you know?
I love when Instagram, then you look at Instagram a little closer and it says one request.
Yeah.
And you're like, what is that?
I've gotten real messages for like bookings on there that I'm like, what the?
I'm like, this was not here when I looked at this 5 minutes ago. It's now, yeah. Somehow that has become an acceptable way of communication, the DM on Instagram, and I don't buy it.
I'm boycotting. Yeah. I'm not about it.
Also, anyone who books, like at least Facebook has now become an acceptable messaging, but if you're booking through Instagram, I mean, I do it. I guess I do it. So.
I don't know.
You really backtracked on that.
I really did. I was like, I started thinking in my head, I'm like, oh, that last guest. Oh, yeah, Thursday, I guess we did do that. Eh, never mind.
It's just crazy to think about what you're putting out there versus what's coming in and stuff like that. Like, on my Instagram, if I'm getting serious booking requests, I'm like, okay, well, there's a picture of my butt in front of Mount Rushmore, but absolutely, let's work together, you know?
Sure. You know what's the worst? Facebook stories. There's Instagram stories. Now there's Facebook stories. And I'm always like, I don't know any of those people who have made stories. And
it's always people I made friends with like 7 years ago at a house party. And I'm like, who is this stranger?
And why am I so into it?
And why is everything to do the boringest thing I've ever seen?
I'm not even watching the videos, but even with statuses, we're learning too much. Like, I cannot handle seeing one other person being the worst and asking about raising money online for something that's arbitrary, but then also posting about the things they just bought. Yeah. Like, I can't.
Like, come on.
Rena Kalm can be seen on Top 10 Tuesdays at 9:30 at the Laugh Factory. Also, she's going to be in Cincinnati this weekend. Go Bananas, Thursday through Sunday. Kyle Scanlon is at Upstand Comedy, which is every Thursday night at Comedy Bar. And at the Lincoln Lodge, the Under the Gun Theater in Lakeview on Friday night. All right, here are the prizes. Ready? First place tonight is going to get you a 3-month semi-private training membership, including unlimited training every day and an athletic evaluation at Redline Athletics in Buffalo Grove. Kids can train like a pro athlete using the same Fusionetics science that college and pro sports teams use. Details at redlineathletics.com/Buffalo Grove. Pair of tickets, see MASH star Jamie Farr at the MAC Center, Tuesdays with Maury on September 30th. Story that changed millions of lives. Enjoy the MAC season kickoff party before the show. Tickets 630-942-4000 or visit at themac.org or Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's is good as home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations. Order online at loumalnati's.com. All right, you ready?
Yes.
We have decided third place is going to be 773 at a coffee shop today. Parents buy a sprinkled donut for their 3-year-old son who's super excited. As he eats the donut, they encourage him to share, but he refuses. When he's not looking, the parents eat the rest of the donut, and the kid has a meltdown.
Yes. I love those parents.
That's great. Number two is going to be 630. The worst is walking down a narrow sidewalk or an aisle in a building towards a couple who are walking holding hands, and they defiantly refuse to get over like they are insecurely permanently attached. Pathetically, older couples do this often.
Yeah. I like the not being scared to go after old people.
Yeah.
I like that move.
No fear. And number one tonight, 608, the worst, when someone's excited to see you, greeting you by name, and you can't remember who they are or how you know them. The last time this happened to me, I said, hey, remind me how to spell your last name again. And he replied, S-M-I-T-H. Good bit.
Man, can't believe me and Rena are going to steal that joke. Yeah.
Exactly. You guys, Kyle, Rena, great to see you guys. Thanks for being
in
the studio.
Thanks so much for
having
us.
Can't wait to do it again.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for the show tonight. coming up tomorrow night. We've got a good David Koechner's going to join us.
Ooh,
yeah,
fun.
David Koechner, yeah. And also Dean Richards is going to be here. So we got a great show lined up tomorrow night. Patty Vasquez up next with Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez.